Blog Talk Radio.
Take my love, take my land, take me where I cannot stand. I don't care, I'm still free, you can't take the sky from me. Take me out to the black, tell them I ain't coming back. Burn the land and boil the sea, can't take the sky from me. There's no place I can be since I found serenity. You can't take the sky from me.
Never mind the bullocks, here's Tex and Rex, irreverent, relevant, and radioactive conservatism with a bite. I'm your host, Tex, broadcasting to you from the, we like to change it up a little bit, from the Old Dominion, right outside the Imperial City, where we are getting ready to celebrate the birthday of a tobacco-growing, gun-owning, moonshine-cooking traitor to the British Crown and our first president under the Constitution. Happy birthday, George Washington.
And this is Rex, broadcasting from Texas, as always. And we've just had a State of the Union given to us by the current president, Barack Obama. So, Rex, what is on the agenda for the week?
Rex, Tex, whatever your name is, the current liar in chief, and that opening song goes out to him. Gave a State of the Disunion pandering speech to Congress, and you know, you and I are really not going to talk much about it because on this show we already take it for a given that the Democrats and the socialists and the communists plain suck. So we're really focused on the
absolutely
the other side of the equation, and this State of the Union speech was so impressive, it required not one, but two responses from the Republican Party. And so we're going to discuss the official Republican response given by Senator Marco Rubio and the unofficial Tea Party response given by Senator Rand Paul. Now, the interesting thing, Tex, is that Marco Rubio was picked because he appeals to the constituency that the Republicans need to gain in order to win future elections. You know, they need Latinos and women and gays and all that meme we've been hearing since the spectacular loss of Roe's Monster. And I think they picked Rubio because he appeals to that constituency because he is young, he is ethnic, and he's a gay woman. So, you know, he's kind of like appealing to everybody.
Excellent. Well, that seems to be the current Republican thought, is that everyone is stuck in various little Travis Bickle tribes out there across the country, and the way you appeal to people is by appealing to people who are in these various tribes rather than appealing to them as Americans with a common set of hopes, dreams, aspirations. And that, of course, is disappointing, I think. Marco Rubio's speech overall, you know, I think it was good, but... I think it was good. It hit some good points, but it was always about rounding off the edges, softening the impact of everything, and not making what I would call a bold choice between the Democrat vision and the Republican vision, and stating what we would do instead, the direction that the country would go, and how their plans were much better for the country. A lot of it was complaining about what Obama is doing. We know that. The Republican Party has been complaining about Obama for 4 years, with good reason. But the question is, what are we going to do now? And what is the legislation that's going to be effective that's going to come through Congress? And what is our bold vision of America that stands in contrast to Obama's vision? And I just didn't really get that very much from Rubio. Of course, he does have a compelling family story that I think he told, but I think he relied a bit too heavily on that was one of the things. Plus, if you're going to take a sip of water, set that glass of water at eye level.
Yeah.
You know, well, not at eye level, but on camera, so you can see when he reaches for it that it's there and it's been established that it's there and it's okay to drink. Don't go off camera to do it. And if you do, certainly don't bend over 2-3 feet. How far did he bend? I don't know. Anyway, it just looked bad. I think they overemphasized that a bit way too much just because they're looking for some sort of criticism of what he did. Yeah.
A bit? Well, Tex, you're absolutely right about it. I mean, I guess we should get that whole, you know, Watergate thing out of the way. I don't really blame Rubio for that. I got plenty of other things to pick a bone with this guy. But, you know, it was the idiots that staged the thing. I mean, they're trying so hard with the drapes and the flag and trying to, you know, make him look presidential, I guess, that it didn't occur to them that the dude might get thirsty in a 13, 14-minute speech and need to take a little sip and, you know, maybe put a little closer. I mean, Rand Paul, even though he didn't need to take a drink, had a glass of water on the podium where he was standing and speaking. So, you know, I don't fault Rubio for that. That's whoever was staging it. But the interesting thing, Tex, is...
it did occur to him that he might need a glass of water because one was there available to him. But they put it on a footstool, is what it looked like. That really was the issue. How far did he bend over to pick that thing up?
They should fire the prop guy, you know? I mean,
yeah.
It's just bad staging. But the interesting thing is that Time Warner went from last week hailing Marco Rubio as the savior of the GOP on the cover of Time magazine to having, they don't own MSLSD, but MSLSD or MSNBC played the whole water thing 155 times in the past week. CNN hit it 34 times, and even alleged fair, balanced, conservative Fox News played it 12 times. And this is the kind of crap that they use to distract you from what's actually going on. They can say, oh, we talked about the State of the Union 256 times. Well, if 255 of those times are talking about Marco Rubio's faux pas and getting a drink, I mean, the dude got thirsty. Guess what? While we're broadcasting, I go through, well, I'm going through a couple of bottles of water. It's Lent, so I'm not having my typical Guinness. But, you know, you drink when you're talking. You get thirsty. So that's not unusual. And for people to pick on him for that is just, you know, that's just stupid. So let's get that out of the way. The other thing that we should get out of the way, Tex, is that even though we're going to talk about Rubio and Rand, this isn't really about Rubio or Rand. Basically, these two guys right now are kind of like a proxy battle for what's really going on in the conservative/Republican spectrum of politics here. We've got the kind of tepid, as you said, you know, establishment that wants to, you know, cover everything, and you've got the real authentic conservatism. And I think that here we've got two representatives, Marco Rubio and Rand Paul, both junior senators, both allegedly Tea Party favorites. You got to ask yourself why the Republicans picked Rubio and why the, quote, Tea Party, whatever that is, needed to have another response from someone other than Marco Rubio. And so I think that the discussion will focus on that. And, you know, I thought Rand Paul's speech was spectacularly superior. And I'll throw this out there probably. Yeah,
I thought it was a better speech because there was less sort of appeal to emotion, I guess, and, you know, sort of what I would call the soft side of politics. Now, of course, in Washington, they would say, well, that's why it's not as an effective speech, because people don't pay attention to this stuff. And Rand Paul sitting there talking all this, you know, wonkish stuff about the Constitution, and that turns people off. but for Rubio's, you know, perspective, or at least my perspective on what's going on with Rubio, is he's being handled, he's being managed, he's being groomed. And so, you know, he perhaps wrote part of that speech, and then it's got to go through a whole process before it gets approved, and that's where they start rounding off the edges and making sure that nothing is said that would be viewed as, you know, causing any sort of controversy. There were no big policy ideas there. And realistically, you know, let's be honest, the State of the Union is kind of a stupid exercise. It's very Soviet, where you have the president going, giving this speech.
A new five-year
then,
plan.
Yeah. Here's my five-year plan and my four-year term. Everything happens in the fifth year. That's basically how it starts. But, you know, then you have the members of the president's party. They stand up and they applaud everything that he says, as if, you know, he is the dear leader without flaw and everything, while the other party sits there and scowls and tisks, and then they applaud at sort of the I guess, inopportune moments, or whenever the president or is talking about something that they would support, or saying, I don't support this, and then they applaud because they support it, but I do support this, and then his party buys stuff. So it's a pretty stupid exercise. And then to have the judicial branch there listening to this nonsense is kind of stupid. And then to have the members of the military there as well. So I think it's a very staged event. It's not authentic. Most of what you hear, you have already heard before. They will propose some new spending programs in a country that is already spending itself into oblivion. And then the worst part about it is someone came up with the idea of, hey, we should have a response to the State of the Union, the party that is not currently holding the executive branch should have a response to this. And it will never be as good. It can't be as good, because the president is speaking in Congress, which is a dumb idea that shouldn't be doing. I think it was Woodrow Wilson's idea originally to go deliver the thing in person, because he was a professor. He thought that would be a good idea. Until then, he's been sending mailing letters. That's what Jefferson did, is mailed letters up to them stating what his policies and agenda were. So he has the backdrop of Congress as if everybody's supporting this stuff. And meanwhile, you know, Marco Rubio is sitting there in a darkened room, you know, with curtains and flags behind him and water sitting on a footstool. It's not
a good
contrast.
But wait, if you order now, we'll throw in not one so-to response, but two.
Absolutely. If that one didn't work, it's like a top 10 list. If that joke didn't work, don't worry. There's another one coming right after it. Okay, did that one work? Okay, that didn't work. All right. Pretty soon, every senator will give their rebuttal to the president's speech until one of them sticks or something.
Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, I think that the whole thing is an exercise in mental masturbation. It doesn't really change anything. It's just designed to glamorize the, you know, like you said, the dear leader, as opposed to give any. I mean, look, the truth of the matter is not that we shouldn't care who the president is, but really the president should be, other than in times of actual declared war, relatively inconsequential. In fact, we're celebrating George Washington's birthday tomorrow, the first president of the Constitution, but I think we had 8 presidents prior to him under the Articles of Confederation. Now, those were technically presidents of the Congress as opposed to a separate executive, but, you know, and of course here in the Commonwealth of Virginia, and for anybody living south of me, we've had 45 because we had Jefferson Davis after Lincoln.
Oh, good president, that guy. Come on.
So,
I think
he was
like one of the worst executives in the history of the country. Anyway, sorry.
You Texans have always considered the rest of the United States your backyard, but we happen to think Jefferson Davis was an all right guy. But besides
the point. I have
not come
to praise Jefferson Davis, but to bury him. Anyway.
but I think the point is that we've turned the presidency into a monarchy, so the State of the Union thing is important, and then, of course, you know, the parties need to stay viable in people's minds, so they've got to give this response, and, the whole thing is kind of sick. But it does illustrate a very important point in the Republican Party, and again, you know, you and I rarely talk about the Democrats because they suck, but the real – and frankly – they're succeeding at what they're doing. They have an agenda. They want to change the nature of the Constitution, the nature of the country, and they're winning. And why are they winning? It's because the Republicans don't know how to fight. And I think that that's really the problem, which in my opinion makes the Republicans worse than the Democrats, because the Democrats have absolutely no standing on principle. I mean, you know, their ideas have always failed. They will continue to fail. They'll never succeed, and they'll always unravel and create chaos in the end. And the Republicans are supposed to be the ones standing up for principles that actually work, the principles that our founding fathers gave us, and they're doing such a piss-poor job of it that they're on their heels. And I think that Rubio's speech was basically an apologetic. He basically pointed fingers at Obama and said, Mr. President, you did this. Mr. President, you did that. Mr. President, you did this. And we stand for this, this, and this. That's friggin' wonderful what you stand for, pal. How are you going to do it? And, you know, you look at the Republicans that are actually successful. Go ahead.
One of the things you said is that the Republicans don't know how to fight. I don't think that's quite necessarily the case. I think they do know how to fight. The problem is you can't fight the people who are ostensibly on your team and talking about the larger fight that you're supposed to be battling don't really believe in that fight, because you have sort of the growth of government party, which is the Democrat Party, which is why, you know, people talk about socialism and everybody's like, hey, I think that's code for, you know, something. Really, it's code for the growth of government into more and more parts of economic activity, which essentially is what socialism is. And communism, of course, is that government should control the commanding heights of the economy. So you have a party that wants government to control more and more, and that always works out well. If you go read history, countries that are under complete government control, nothing bad ever happens because governments are perfect.
Fantastic.
Flawless. Exactly. But the problem you have on the Republican side is ostensibly the Republican Party is about limited governments, you know, smaller the government role in the economy, more economic freedom, and the libertarian movement, which actually is kind of interesting, in the U.S. is allied with the party that is considered the party of the right, which in a lot of countries is not the case. But, you know, so our libertarian movement is in the Republican Party, the party of the right. But the problem is you have a lot of established Republicans who have been in Washington for years, and their bread is buttered on the side of growing government, because that makes them more powerful. So you have people in the party who are trying to increase their power and, therefore, who don't
disagree with the Democrats on practical grounds. Maybe they disagree on ideological grounds, but on the practical grounds of divvying up the spoils, they're all for it. And so it's not that the Republicans necessarily don't know how to fight, but it's very difficult to fight when people who are supposed to be on your side in that fight are inside the command tent, and they are working practically with the people who are supposed to be on the other side. Now, of course...
Yes! Fifth column.
There you go.
But they are. They're a fifth fucking column. And I got to say that, you know, ostensibly we had two Tea Party guys, right? Because I hear it all the time in the media or wherever I see an article, you know, Tea Party favorite Marco Rubio, Tea Party favorite Rand Paul, whatever the hell that means, you know. But then why would you have to have both of them, you know, respond? If Marco Rubio is such a Tea Party guy, then
if there
why
is
the
no
Tea Party?
Tea Party, as they always say, there's no real Tea Party, how can the Tea Party have a favorite?
Yeah.
I'll leave that alone.
Well, you can't have it both ways, but that's, you know, postmodern deconstructionist lack of critical thinking here. But what I found interesting was, you know, Rubio was very classic establishment Republican, which is basically point fingers at the other guys, bitch about what they're doing, and then, you know, make some platitudes towards the principles, you know, in which we believe. Okay, that's great. But guess what? Obama made platitudes of those same principles when he was running, and look what he's done. Rand Paul, actually, to me, was... His response was interesting. By the way, for all of you boys and girls out there in radio land, if you want to listen to both speeches, just go to the Tex and Rex show page on Facebook or join the group Tex and Rex's Liberty Militia, and I've got links to both full speeches as well as some articles comparing them. But in any event, we're not really so much focused on what they said and what they didn't say, but kind of the general principles. And what I found interesting about Rand Paul's speech is that he did attack Obama's mistakes, and he made a case for the principles which Republicans allegedly stand for, as we've stated in the platform and such. And then he talked about how he would, you know, actually do something about it. And I this is probably going to piss off traditional conservative Republicans as well as libertarian Republicans, because I will say that Rand Paul's speech was quite Gingrich-esque or even Reagan-esque, because it wasn't just platitudes, it was substantive and it was pithy. He didn't, you know, have to give me a treatise on economics or civil liberties in order for me to understand what he was talking about. And I think that it was rather powerful, at least as far as a response to a State of the Union can be. But I think it indicates where Republicans win is when they're actually conservative, they stand on those principles, and they fight for them no matter how unpopular or controversial they are. You know, Reagan was controversial. Gingrich was controversial. God knows Ron Paul was controversial. And, you know, I'll say this, though, real quick, is that the difference I see with, you know, and I know a lot of libertarians are, Rand Paul's not Ron Paul. No shit. He's his son, and he's not going to be a clone of him. He is his own person. But I find that Rand Paul can articulate authentic conservative. Yeah, he articulates authentic conservative principles in a more direct, palpable manner than Ron Paul did. Now, one of the problems with Ron Paul is that unless you understand his principles and his philosophy, which unfortunately way too many so-called conservatives and Republicans don't understand, sometimes he's hard to follow.
In explaining it?
Well, exactly. But, you know, sometimes he's hard to follow. I found Rand to be a little bit more digestible. Now, I know you Ron Paul purists out there can't stand Rand Paul, and you traditional Republicans think he's exactly like his dad and dangerous to the party. Let me break it to both of you. Y'all need to learn to get along, because as long as we're divided on the, you know, 15% on which we disagree as opposed to the 85% on which we agree, the other guys are an unstoppable juggernaut, and we're going to fall further and further into European bureaucratic socialism and possibly, you know, Soviet-style communism if y'all don't get your shit together and start getting along. Because the fact is that the differences, the 15% differences, are friggin' minor. I've heard people tell me on both sides, oh, actually, there are big differences. Well, guess what? Fight about them after we displace these guys. after we displace these guys. Not now. If you keep fighting about them now, then you might as well just, you know, give up the field, you know, take your ball and go home, because it's going to be a Democrat ball game for the next 20 or 40 years.
Well,
and
the
Republican Party
has a big tent, right? They always talk about, oh, the Democrat Party has this big tent. Well, the Republican Party has a big tent. We've got a lot of different factions within the Republican Party. We're not monolithic, as the media tries to portray us, or as the leadership tries to portray us. And the problem is, the faction that has been running things, and straight to the ground, I might add, for over a decade, is the Rhino Wing, the establishment Republicans. And they say, good, we should be running things because we're wiser than the passions of the people, and we know what we're doing. But clearly they don't, because the party is doing worse and worse and worse under their leadership. And so there are differences between the various wings of the Republican Party, but they need to make common cause at the moment to move the Rhino Republican establishment wing of the party to the side, because they are actively out there trying to get rid of people who believe what we believe and who will not go along with the Washington establishment view of the world, which is really the government knows best, transfer more authority over there, and things will get better. So we got to make common cause, and we have to start looking at the minute things that separate us and look at getting control of the party back in the hands of the grassroots of the party, because that way it can actually succeed. What we just saw at Tampa since then is the establishment has taken the reins of control of the party, and the grassroots, basically, under their current rules, has no voice, and they don't want it to have a voice.
Correct. And here's the thing, though, and I've you know, we've done several shows about this. We did a big push for Mark Willis, who was the only man courageous enough to even attempt to challenge Prince Pubic for the RNC chair. We got, you know, we did a show on Karl Rover and his conservative assassination project. But the fact is that if you keep the pressure up, eventually they have to play to you. Now, at first, it will simply be slightly walking back their previous hard line. Rove's already walking back and saying, oh, we gave $2.9 million from my PAC to Tea Party guys. Okay, whatever. Fuck you, Carl. And then they'll start.
$400 million, he gave $2.9.
Yeah.
It was
you
a mistake. He didn't even know he was doing it.
What? It's a rounding error, okay? So fuck you, Carl. And then they'll start pandering in kind of an attempt to appropriate you by bringing you back into the fold with some rhetoric without actually giving any substance. If you keep the pressure up, eventually they'll realize, wow, we really screwed ourselves with these stupid rules and not listening to these people, because without them, we got no shot at winning. Now, they think that they can make up for those of us, because let's face it, I would argue that more than half the, quote, Republican voters, whether they're in the party or not, are not pleased with what's going on, but they will, you know, swallow their principles and vote for their chosen rhino, as they did with the one whose name we won't mention, Rose Monster, in the last election. But more and more of us are saying, no, you know what, if you put up a shitty candidate who doesn't believe anything I believe, I don't care what party he's in, I don't care how bad the other guy is, I'm not voting for him. And I think more people will say that, and their initial attempt is going to be to replace you. To be like, well, we don't need these, you know, controversial, small government, states' rights, nullification kooks in our party. So we're going to replace them with, you know, by appealing to ethnics and gays and women. And that's not going to work. I mean, we know that's going to fail because the Democrats have already been playing that game, and they've got that game down. So you can't play that game, because you have to sell out your conservative principles to play that stupid identity game anyway. I mean, like, you're going to vote for somebody because of their genitals or their skin color. If that's how you're going to vote, then you're not really qualified to vote. Vote for what, not even what they say, but what they actually do. That's what you vote on. And people who are male or female, black, white, brown, yellow, red, whatever, are going to vote for somebody who's going to give them more power to improve their lot and live their life as they see fit than they are for somebody who just appears to be like them. I mean, that's the reality. So the people who are going to only vote on those issues, you know, genitals and skin color, they're Democrat voters. So Republicans aren't going to get them no matter what they do. So they're going to come around to realizing that they need us if you don't let up and keep on the pressure. Now, again, Tex and Rex, we're for conservatism properly understood as conserving the principles enshrined in liberal documents, principally the Declaration and the Constitution, wherever. And when I say wherever, some of you are, you know, oh, the Republican Party sucks, screw the Republican Party, I'm out. I'm going to the Libertarian Party, the Constitution Party, or I'm not even voting anymore. And others of you are like, well, you know, I'm going to vote for the Republican loser no matter who he is just because he's not the Democrat. Well, you know, both of you are kind of a little wrong, and I'm not telling somebody what they have to do. You do what you is in your conscience. But the reality is support conservatives wherever they are, whether they're in the Republican Party, the Libertarian Party, the Constitution Party, or anywhere else. That's how you have to play the game. And first you have to decide, well, what is a conservative, and where can I disagree with a candidate and on a particular issue, provided that the overall principles that we're moving towards are those of good governance according to the Constitution and conservative principles. And that's, I think, the difference we saw between Rubio, who's kind of a cardboard cutout guy, and Rand Paul, who's got significant substance. And, you know, Rubio, right? He was the, quote, Tea Party candidate running against who?
That would be Charlie Crist, who was running against. And
okay.
He was behind by double digits to Charlie Crist, and he caught on with the Republican base probably because they found out, oh, this guy's, you know, actually talking about the things we care about, whereas Charlie Crist is talking about selling us out. And so he ended up winning against Charlie Crist, but there's a little secret about Charlie Crist, isn't there? Something about the type of politics that he's interested in. Is that correct?
Yeah. Yeah, I'm pretty sure, Rex, that he was a little blue, should we say, in his politics?
Yeah. And then I believe it was December of 2012, he announced that he is now a Democrat.
Yeah.
So,
oh, imagine that.
So Marco Rubio's Tea Party creds, and, you know, I'm not disparaging necessarily his conservatism, but he is being handled by the party at the moment and being groomed for better things, which, I don't know, me being myself, I always view sort of suspiciously. His credential is that he's more conservative than Charlie Crist, who's a Democrat. So,
yeah.
You know, he was a rhino, he was a Republican in name only, truly, because he left the party as soon as he could. He's someone who got in through the wire somehow and was on our side, you know, at our parties talking with us as if he was one of us and believed these things, and then when he got a chance, he switched over to the Democrat Party. Well, who does that? You know, if you actually believe these things.
Arlen Specter?
Yeah, Arlen Specter.
I'm just waiting for Chris Christie to do it.
Yeah. Complete political opportunist. I mean, famously, Michael Bloomberg, you know, is a Republican,
yep.
but not really. He's
yep.
a Democrat, and they told him that he couldn't run in the Democrat primary because they already had their guy. And so
yep.
he said, okay,
just,
well, screw you, I'll run as a Republican. And he did.
Just like Rove's Monster, whose name we won't mention.
Precisely.
You know, and that's what people need to wake up to. I mean, look, you take a moderate, tepid, you know, whatever guy like Rubio, and you run him against a guy like Crist, and all of a sudden it's like, oh, Rubio's awesome. Well, I mean, if you compare something bad to something worse, the bad thing will look better. That doesn't make it good, you know? So until you start demanding more, you ain't going to get more. And I guess we should probably at least hear a little bit of this speech that Rubio gave. I got a couple of clips, and we'll play some Rand clips just so that we got something to talk to. We got about 90 minutes of show left. Taking calls in the second hour. Call the number 646-649-1013. That's 646-649-1013. Tex, I'm going to play a 2.5-minute Rubio clip from the speech, and then we can you know, rip on him after that.
All right, let's go.
There's There are valid reasons to be concerned about the president's plan to grow our government. But anytime anyone opposes the president's agenda, he and his allies usually respond by falsely attacking their motives. When we point out that no matter how many job-killing laws we pass, our government can't control the weather, he accuses us of wanting dirty water and dirty air. When we suggest we strengthen our safety net programs by giving states more flexibility to manage them, he accuses us of wanting to leave the elderly and the disabled to fend for themselves. And tonight, he even criticized us for refusing to raise taxes to delay military cuts, cuts that were his idea in the first place. But his favorite attack of all is that those of us who don't agree with him, that we only care about rich people. Mr. President, I still live in the same working-class neighborhood I grew up in. My neighbors aren't millionaires. They're retirees who depend on Social Security and Medicare. They're workers who have to get up early tomorrow morning and go to work to pay the bills. They're immigrants who came here because they were stuck in poverty in the countries where the government dominated the economy. The tax increases and this deficit spending you propose will hurt middle-class families. It will cost them their raises. It will cost them their benefits. It may even cost some of them their jobs. And it will hurt seniors because it does nothing to save Medicare and Social Security. So, Mr. President, I don't oppose your plans because I want to protect the rich. I oppose your plans because I want to protect my neighbors. The president loves to blame the debt on President Bush, but President Obama has created more debt in 4 years than his predecessor did in 8. The real cause of our debt is that our government has been spending $1 trillion more than it takes in every year. That's why we need a balanced budget amendment. The biggest obstacle to balancing the budget are programs where spending is already locked in. One of these programs is Medicare. It's especially important to me. It provided my father the care he needed to battle cancer and ultimately to die with dignity. And it pays for the care my mother receives right now. I would never support any changes to Medicare that would hurt seniors like my mother. But anyone who's in favor of leaving Medicare exactly the way it is right now is in favor of bankrupting it.
And that was Sean Hannity. Oh, no, that was not Sean Hannity. That was Senator Marco Rubio. I mean, Tex.
Don't hurt his mother.
That wasn't a terrible speech. He didn't say anything I disagree with. He didn't say anything super exciting. He didn't say anything wrong. But frankly, he sounded like Sean Hannity. I mean, I don't want Sean Hannity in office. Sean Hannity is, you know, a cheerleader for the Republican Party and quite possibly a moron, and he's fine on his job on radio and TV. This is a senator. I expect a little bit more from him. And he didn't deliver. And then, you know, it's nice to throw out the story of, yeah, I'm an immigrant. Well, you know, I don't care. I don't care if you're an immigrant or if you were born here, if your ancestors go back here 400 years, or if you arrived on a boat through the front door yesterday. You're an American, and that's all that matters. You have the same opportunities and the same dignity as everybody else. So don't give me the special stuff by tugging on my heartstrings. And then the whole thing with the whole Medicare thing. I'm like, look, Medicare is a monopoly. Ever since 1965, it has been the only medical care insurance provided for people above the age of 65. So, you know, when you tell me that that's what took care of somebody I love, well, there's nothing else. Maybe if we had some competition, something else could have done a better job, you know. So not a bad speech, but again, nothing much there. What would you say?
Well, I would say one thing, you know, when you're trying to convince someone of your position or bring them over on board to your vision, what is with this, you know, woe is me, hey, they're mean to me, they always accuse me of this, when I say this, they accuse me of this. Forget about that. I mean, that right there, you're on the defensive, you're buying into the narrative. Just go make your narrative and let them be the ones who are sitting there attacking you. Don't say, hey, I think it's unfair when they say that, and you should think it's unfair too. Because at that point, the only people who believe you are the people who already are on your side. No one's coming over and saying, you know what, I think that's unfair too. I mean, the world just doesn't work that way. So I found that to be overly defensive and unconvincing. And, you know, that's kind of a kiss of death, really, in a speech. But I'm sure that the RNC, who I'm pretty much guarantee went through this speech and didn't approve it until he got out, they thought this was great stuff because they're like, hey, this makes us look like the victim, and therefore we can claim the moral high ground.
Oh, God, you know, not the moral high ground. That's the last thing you want, just the moral high ground of these types of things, you know. That's what, after 9/11, people were saying about attacking Afghanistan. Well, you shouldn't attack Afghanistan because before you attacked Afghanistan, America had the moral high ground. What good was that doing us? You know, that really is the problem. But apparently, the Republican Party and the RNC thinks that Marco Rubio was able to go out and establish the moral high ground for us. So look forward to more defeats after that, because I don't think anyone was convinced by that.
He didn't establish any moral high ground. He didn't. I mean, he didn't even put on his big boy panties for the speech. I mean, you know. I mean, it was tepid. There wasn't anything substantively wrong with it, but it just didn't. There was no meat, and it was, like you said, it was defensive. He was basically like, you know, don't accuse us of wanting dirty water, Mr. President. We want clean water too. Really? I mean, you're gonna respond using the terminology of the enemy. You know, set your own agenda. We have principles that have a proven record of working, and they have principles that have a proven record of failure. And yet this party is defending itself against their accusations when they're the ones who have the record of failure. It's kind of pathetic. And the interesting thing to me, I think Rand showed a serious amount of sec compared especially with Rubio, because he came out to swinging, and he didn't only punch the president, he punched the rhinos. Let's take a listen to a little 1 minute or so on. Do I have it? Yeah, Rand Paul. Here's about a minute on Rand Paul.
Tonight I urge you to demand a new course. Demand Washington change their ways or be sent home. To begin with, we absolutely must pass a balanced budget amendment to the Constitution. The amendment must include strict tax and spending limitations. Liberals complain that the budget can't be balanced, but if you cut just one penny from each dollar we currently spend, the budget would balance within 6 or 7 years. The penny plan has been crafted into a bill that millions of conservatives across the country support. It is often said there's not enough bipartisanship up here. That's not true. In fact, there's plenty of bipartisanship. Both parties have been guilty of spending too much, of protecting their sacred cows, of backroom deals in which everyone up here wins, but every taxpayer loses. It's time for a new bipartisan consensus. It's time Democrats admit that not every dollar spent on domestic programs is sacred, and it's time Republicans, myself included, realize that military spending is not immune to waste and fraud.
Now, that had some sack to it. Wouldn't you agree?
Absolutely. 100%. I mean, there he's taking the battle right, you know, rolling it right up to the doorstep.
I mean, look at the challenge he just gave them. He gave both parties a challenge. You can't even cut 1%, a real 1%, not a fictitious 1% out of a future increase, but a real 1% out of the current budget. You don't even have the guts to cut 1%. I mean, 1% is not going to devastate any program. It's not going to make us less safe. It isn't going to deprive grandma of her Social Security check or her Medicare benefits. 1% is not going to do that. So, you know, why can't we do that? And he just threw it to both of them. That's a substantive position that and he used the language, you know, a new bipartisan consensus, because, you know, you and I both know bipartisan in D.C. usually means Mr. and Mrs. America, you're fucked because we're working together to screw you. He's saying,
yeah,
why don't you work together to cut spending instead of just defending your pet peeve programs for your party? Why don't we cut spending across the board? Because let's face it, the Pentagon can afford cuts of much more than 1% without decreasing our defense or security one iota. And that's the same for all the welfare programs on the left. So, you know, I thought that was ballsy.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and I'm sort of stalling for time as I find Marco Rubio is talking about cuts to the defense budget as well, but he was talking about disastrous cuts to our defense budget. But the reality is the United States spends more money on its military than the rest of the world put together, essentially. So, you know, if there were to be cuts in that budget, I don't think that they would be ruinous cuts by any measure. That's not to say you should just go cutting everything, but Nor is that to say that the military spending is our biggest problem, because really our biggest problem is that we're spending money we don't have and the growth of the debt, but also it's, quote, mandatory spending or entitlement spending that's growing out of control. But you have to, if you're going to get this agreement, you have to be able to look at the military budget.
Yeah, I agree. I think that Rubio
said, you know, I'd say that since we're on the right, this to us is our, quote, sacred cow. So I'm saying this has to be something that we look at. So I'm talking to a friend in the audience here about what our sacred cows are. And I think anybody, you know, who's being honest would say, okay, yeah, there are places that we can cut, because it's not like the military budget is free from waste, fraud, and abuse, which always is one of the idiotic things to go from, but a bunch of boondoggles and programs that just don't make any sense at all and probably need to be eliminated.
Yeah. Now, what Tex, the current defense budget is, what, $450 billion, something like that?
Yep, right in that neighborhood, a little north of there.
Yeah. So Rubio in the speech, and this article is it's on the Tex and Rex show page as well as in the Tex and Rex Liberty Militia, is from, who, I don't know who wrote it. Well, this is the Washington Times, Seth McLaughlin. And Rubio said, of the $86 billion sequester, $86 billion sequester, includes devastating cuts to our military that should be replaced with responsible spending reforms. The sequester is $86 billion across the entire budget, right? So how much of that $86 billion is coming out of the $450 billion defense budget? How much? I mean, it's a drop in the bucket.
Yeah. And this is one of the things in Rand Paul's speech, actually, he talks about, and so this is a quote, the president does a big, quote, woe is me over the $1.2 trillion sequester that he endorsed and signed into the law. So it was the president's idea. But the thing about that $1.2 trillion figure that I would quibble with Rand Paul on is that's the 10-year figure. The actual figure for 2013 is $85 billion. And so you're talking about, if you stretch it out to 10 years, you're talking about a $1.2 trillion sequester or reduction in government spending in out of $46 trillion that's going to be spent over that time. I mean, that is a negligible cut or reduction. Yeah. I mean, that's the problem. It's not even cut. I mean, a cut's a cut. This is a reduction in growth of spending. So, you know, you have to understand what all the hemming and hawing over is $85 billion out of budget for a government that currently is deeply in debt. And trying to pull up a fact here for you. But the budget is $3.6 trillion. And so you're talking about $85 billion for the cuts, and this is the worst thing that could ever possibly happen. I mean, everyone's taxes just went up. I mean, you saw your own paychecks, I would assume, if you're fortunate enough to be getting one in this economy. And you just got a tax cut, or you just got a tax increase. So your paycheck was cut. So, you know, you're talking about $85 billion. Well, you know, it's time for the government to tighten its belt as well, because when the government tightens its belt, your funds are released back to you to go do what you want to do with your money. So all this talk of, which is really a misnomer, I think, of government austerity and the age of austerity is here. Well, it's austerity for government. For you, it's relief. So we should be happy about this. It's the age of relief. But the problem is, into our system, we've written in all these cost of living increases so that every year the amount of money they need to spend goes up and up and up, and every year they have to come back with another tax increase until it's like the giving tree. The American taxpayers like the giving tree, and the government is always coming back to take something else from the giving tree until the giving tree has given everything that it can and there's nothing left. But it will always come back, and that's the problem.
Well, and the problem is that you've got so many people who have been conditioned to be reliant on government that they hear government austerity, they think my program is getting cut. And the answer is, yes, it is. You know, yes, it is. Because if your program gets cut, it might hurt for a little while, but in the long run, you'll have more to do with what you think is best for you as opposed to what some bureaucrat, you know, middle-level, you know, do-gooder, fiefdom builder is going to tell you what to do with your money. And the fact is that the Republicans and the Democrats do this. I mean, Mitt Romney's 47% comment, okay, was in some sense not incorrect, insensitive and stupidly stated, but not totally incorrect, but the Republicans are just as guilty of it. The difference is the Democrats believe that they should that all your money belongs to them, and they decide how much of it you get to keep and what they do with the rest of it, because they know better than you, because you're a stupid person. That's how they look at you. The Republicans, on the other hand, think, no, we should let them keep more of their money, provided they do with it what we want them to do. So they'll give you a tax incentive to do a certain behavior, whether it is to take out a mortgage or, you know, have another kid or whatever it is, and then you can keep more of your money. Both of them are managing your behavior. One is doing it directly by stealing your money and then telling you what they're going to do with it. The other one is telling you, well, you can keep the money as long as you do X with it. Neither one of them is allowing you to decide. And the fact is that you should decide, because a growing economy requires independent actors making independent decisions, because all of us, out of a rational self-interest, will use our money to the highest and best use. Now, some people will start coming at me saying, well, that's just promoting greed. No, greed is something that occurs in your heart. It doesn't occur with your money. That's, you know, in the Bible, it clearly says the love of money is the root of all evil. It doesn't say money is the root of all evil. Money is a neutral, non-moral actor. It's the love of it. So when you get to keep more of your money, you get to decide what the highest and best use is, and that might be in charity to give it away to somebody who needs it more. But that's your choice. It can't be forced. It's not charity when it's forced, because there's no love. It's confiscation and redistribution. And both of them do it. What Rand Paul is talking about is cut the spending. Because the more government eats, the more it goes into debt, the less that there is in the free market economy, which means the less that you, Mr. and Mrs. America, have to do with what you think is best, and whether that is to start a business and hire people, give it away to those in need, or merely to store it away for your future retirement, college savings, or rainy day. And when you store it away, people think that, oh, that's dead money. Well, no, unless you put it under your mattress. And I'm not saying you shouldn't put some of it under your mattress, but when you put it away, you save it, that creates capital to be sent to where the entrepreneurs have the skill to put it to its highest and best use and grow the economy. Because the only way you get out of the hole you've built is to grow your way out of the hole. You cannot borrow your way out of a fucking hole. That's like saying that, okay, honey, let's sit around the table and let's look at our budget. Okay, we're bringing in $5,000 a month, and we are spending $6,000 a month. We're borrowing that extra $1,000 a month. By the end of the year, we're going to be another $12,000 in the hole. What do you think we should do to fix that problem? Well, why don't we borrow $24,000, and then we'll have an extra $2,000 a month to spend? That doesn't work. What you should do is cut the $1,000 you don't have. In fact, you should probably cut at least $1,500 so that you spend $4,500 and bank $500. That's not how the government thinks of it. That's how you think of it when you're sitting around your table trying to figure out what to cut. You know, okay, this week we won't eat out, and next week, you know, we're not going to order a pizza. We're going to eat, you know, beans out of a can. The government says, well, you know what, we can just borrow more money. Why? Because the Federal Reserve wants us to borrow more money, because all money is debt, and the more debt that we owe, the more control that they have. And that's what you have to break. The only person up there right now who's discussing it is Rand Paul, and, of course, you know, Paul Braun, I guess, reintroduced Ron Paul's audit, the Fed bill in the House. That's the kind of thing you need, but they get no support. First of all, the media, which is 96% owned by six corporations, isn't going to talk about it. Second of all, most of us are too busy nitpicking over our favorite issue and making sure that our check comes in to even worry about, you know, what these guys are doing that are doing good things and really supporting them. And then, of course, we nitpick. You know, I've heard the criticism, right, Tex? I think Rand Paul in the speech said something like, Obama is borrowing $50,000 a second. And just think about that. Most Americans don't make $50,000 in a year, and the government is borrowing $50,000 a second. Of course, the criticism came from the left. Well, that's not actually true. According to the most recent numbers, which we know are mostly bullshit, he's only borrowing $30,000 a second. That's a 40% differential. Well, that's mathematically true. It is 30,000 is 40% less than 50,000. But are you fucking kidding? $30,000 a second? Well, how the hell do you? That's supposed to be a good thing? You know, that's like bashing me in the head with a hammer, and then you stop and you go, hey, you should thank me for stopping from bashing you in the head with a hammer. Hey, how about you don't bash me in the head with a hammer in the first place? You know, so it's insane. So that's the kind of garbage that they use to obfuscate. And then, you know, of course, we'll spend the next 4 hours talking about Marco Rubio taking a drink of water. I mean, give me a break.
Yeah, well, it's not your love for your money that's the problem. It's the government's love for your money that is the problem. Because the government wants your money. That's where the government has an advantage. Because there's two things that it can do. Think of it as if it were a corporation that's selling to customers. And whenever it wants to, it can just increase the price on the customers, and the customers pay the price because they don't have a choice. So there you go. Well, we need more money. Well, we'll just increase prices, and we have a good called taxes, which are completely inelastic because we have an organization that will come to your house and take all their things if they don't pay the new price, the new tax. So that's one way they get it. And then they realize, well, you know, most Americans, they kind of don't like the thought of paying more taxes. So is there some sort of invisible way or painless way that we could get our money? And that, of course, is to print more money. But the money trust didn't really like that idea because printing money didn't get them in debt to the money trust. So they came up with the concept of the Federal Reserve, where you can borrow more money from the Fed, which will do the printing for you, but what it prints is not actual currency, but rather debt. And it essentially is an inflation tax on everyone in the economy, on the American people. And you don't see it because you don't, well, you definitely pay it, but you certainly don't pay it directly, and you don't know it happens or that it's going on. You don't feel it until later. So that's another way that the government's getting your money. So it's the government's love of your money that's really the problem. And Rand Paul also... he mentioned something in the speech that I thought was really important, which was talking about how do you stop this. And one of the things that he said, and I quote, is that the willpower to fix, so he talks about America's poorest world, that almost 1 in 6 people last year reaching a new high, long-term unemployment fell, and millions of Americans struggling are left out of work. The cycle must be broken, the cycle of government spending. And he says the willpower to do this will not come from Congress. It must come from the American people, and that really is the critical thing. The American people have to be the ones who stand up and say that this is enough. That, you know, I've had it up to here. I've paid this bill way too much. You keep coming back and taking and taking and taking, and it's never enough. It's a need that can never be satisfied. And so the problem is the need itself and what's causing the need, not that I'm not contributing enough, that I'm not doing enough. At this point, we've done so much that people are out of work because of it, because you're taxing away the businesses that gave us the money, you know, to provide to you in the form of taxes in the first place. And what's happening as a result of that is the cycle is worsening. Because not only is the tax base being undermined because fewer people are working, but more people are going on to different forms of government assistance, meaning the government's bill is increasing. And so as their bill increases, they come back to the people who are still producing and ask for more money. It's a vicious cycle, and it's got to be broken. But, you know, what Rand Paul is saying is right, is Congress is not going to be the group of people who break that cycle. It has to be the American people who stand up and just say, that's enough.
Yep, and I think that that's a key point to address. Look, I got two clips I want to hit on Rand Paul. One is talking about, you know, Obama's assertion that he's reduced the debt. I mean, I don't even know where we have to address that. It's friggin' obvious. And then I think the other one we need to address, because we're talking so much about Rand Paul and Marco Rubio tonight. We're not talking about 2016, folks. Maybe, you know, these two guys, you know, maybe one's got an eye on 2016, the other one's being groomed for 2016. 2016 is a long time away. All right, we've got major elections in Virginia and New Jersey this year. We've got special elections in several states, including Massachusetts, for Kerry's Senate seat. We got midterms next year, a third of the Senate, all of the House. That's a big deal. And we haven't even hit 2015. Okay, so 2016 is a very, very long time away, and I believe that the media and most of us are, you know, Twitter about what they're doing. So I'm going to let Rand Paul speak about that. He addressed it with Chris Wallace earlier today, so we'll hit that. But the first thing is about Obama actually reducing the deficit, the debt, which he actually claimed in the State of the Union address that he did. Here's Rand Paul.
All right, let's turn to the president's agenda. What's wrong with the idea that the president laid out in the State of the Union that, yes, at this time, particularly when we have such a weak recovery, we need to spend more money, he calls it investment, on education, on infrastructure, on research, especially when Mr. Obama says, if you make cuts in other places, we won't add, his words, a dime to the deficit?
Yeah, he said that about 20 times in the last 4 years. Meanwhile, he added $6 trillion to the debt. I think it's really disingenuous. He said in his speech that he's reduced the debt by $2 trillion. Well, he added $6 trillion. That means because he didn't add $8 trillion, he's reduced it by $2 trillion. That's absurd. He listed about 50 new programs and says, oh, they're not going to cost you anything. We're going to squeeze this money out of the rich. The problem is whenever he tries to squeeze more money out of the economy, he's slowing it down. We slowed down in the fourth quarter, and it's not because government spending's going down. Government spending is still going apace. We still have plenty of government spending. In fact, we spent more in the fourth quarter last year than we did in the third quarter, and we spent more than we did in the previous year. We've never had a real cut in spending in recent history. So I think he's flat out wrong.
I mean, That was pretty nice and direct. You know, Rubio was direct about saying the president is wrong too, but he didn't give us anything other than platitudes. I thought that Rand Paul straightened out pretty clearly. And to me, the fascinating thing is this whole lousy Keynesian idea that even those of us who are ostensibly on the right fall for. You know, government spending does not cause economic growth. Government spending always necessarily causes economic shrinkage. Always. Now, some shrinkage is acceptable provided that it does the things that it's delegated to do. Now, obviously you have operations costs like any other group, so the government, you know, must, you know, be responsible with other people's money. But it needs to pay for its operations. But now we think of government as this conduit for moving wealth around and creating wealth. It does not create wealth, and whenever it moves wealth around, it wicks some away in cost, waste, and fraud, and it always redirects it to political constituencies, not towards the highest and best use for growth. You will never grow your way out of debt if you expect government to do it. The only job government has to do in helping us get out of debt is to release the free market from burdens, to eliminate dangerous taxes like the income tax, and to actually stop spending more than it takes in so that we can grow our way out of this mess. Because we will never, where we are right now, the debt will never be paid off, and an economic collapse and a dollar collapse is inevitable. Now, it can still be avoided because markets operate on expectation and futures. So if we do the right things, then we will signal to the free market and to the rest of the world that we're being responsible, and you'll start seeing some growth movement. It'll be bumpy for a while. It'll get worse before it gets better. But if we don't do this soon, this thing is going to resolve itself with a collapse. And I know some of them want that. Okay. And my opinion is, you know, bring it on, because, you know, our audience has texted, and I don't know if I gave you our numbers, but our audience has never been bigger. And we want to thank each and every one of you out there for posting the show, sharing the show, telling your friends about it, especially Arlene, who's been extremely helpful in getting the show out there, and Mary, and all of our supporters. You all know who you are. I can't mention everybody, but we've never been. We weren't this big, and we were huge around the convention, and we're bigger now than we were around the election when we had a spike in numbers. So people are looking to hear this message of conservative unity, building coalitions with people who we may not necessarily have known before or feel comfortable with, but we're building friendships and building coalitions based on these principles. But no matter what we do, it's really up to you to get that message out there beyond Blog Talk Radio, beyond Facebook in the real world, because until we make a significant sea change in what's going on, a collapse is about the only thing that's going to wake people up. And I tell you, it's going to be one ugly mess. It would be wonderful if we could avoid it. But if all we've got is Obama versus Rubio, it ain't going to happen. And, you know, Rand Paul is not going to do it on his own. Okay, no one's going to fix this on their own. Newt Gingrich is not going to fix this on his own. Ron Paul, Jim DeMint, none of them are going to fix it on their own. And ultimately, it isn't even up to them. Because if they're good leaders, they're going to sift through the BS, they're going to give you the right information, and going to tell you the direction to go in. But it requires you, Mr. and Mrs. America, to make that direction have momentum. And if you don't do the work, if you don't get it, if you don't email them, call them, support them when they do something right and tell them, hey, do more of that, and call them out when they do something wrong, they will never, ever listen to you. And if they don't listen to you, this thing is headed in a terrible direction. We already know that the Republican ship has already sunk. Now the question is, can it be raised? I think it can, and I think it should. And I don't. Even if you've decided you've abandoned the GOP, you know, remember, I'm not a member, you know, and you've gone Libertarian Party or Constitution Party or what have you, the Republican Party is right now the number one brand for conservatism, and so you need it to succeed, not just win elections with any asshole, but actually succeed on conservatism, else the others won't have a chance. Go for it, Tex.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and that, I think, is one of the problems behind Karl Rove's, whatever it is, conservative victory project, is the idea that victory is the most important thing. As long as more members of your team win than the other team, then you've effected change. Well, if the members of your team have the same policies as the member of the team that you just got rid of, it doesn't really matter, because this isn't, you know, a football game where, okay, great, my jersey won, now I feel good. It's a matter of affecting change in the country that's actually substantial and will make a difference. And so if in order to do that, you start bringing members of the other team over, or members of your team who are, quote, on your team but don't really care about it, and they start enacting the same policies, and that's not victory at all. It's defeat by another name. But the worst part is it's defeat by your own team that you supported. Like, hey, we won, and we're going to do exactly the same thing that you hated before. But we won, so you should feel good about that. Well, no, actually, I feel worse about it.
Yep.
Because I was betrayed by my team, you know, the one that they supported what I support. So that's really problematic, and that's where it gets down to looking at your local elections and who's running, finding out what they're running for, what they're running on, and getting involved and paying attention, and voting for the people who most closely believe what you believe. That's how you change it. Because whether or not you have enough R's in office isn't necessarily as important as to whether or not you have enough people who agree with you in Congress. And if you have enough people who agree in constitutional government, limited government, and a free economy, then you're fine. They could all be Democrats. If they believe this thing, it wouldn't really matter what their party affiliation was if they were going back to constitutional government. So keep that in mind. Your team is not what's important in this. It is the people on your team and what they do when they get into office. And as Rex was saying earlier, or Tex, I forget, it's not about victory. It's not about what they say. It's about what they do when they're in office.
Yeah. And the fact is that the other team isn't doing so well either. Okay? I mean, the Democrats were super anti-war. We were getting daily casualty and fatality counts on the wars on TV constantly when it was Bush's wars, right? And then here comes Bush's third term under Obama, and all of a sudden they're all fucking silent about the war. Hey, guess what? War sucks. Sometimes it's necessary. Sometimes you don't have a choice. Sometimes you even have to go overseas to fight wars. Okay, we had to go fight the Nazis, period. And then anybody who says that you didn't, we'd all be speaking German today, okay? Because eventually the Nazis were going to pick a fight with us anyway. At least then we had to, you know, nip it in the bud. So sometimes you have to do it. But war isn't good when your guy is in charge and bad when the other guy's in charge, you know, and that's the hypocrisy of the left, is they were anti-war. I almost, and frankly I didn't care which way it went because it both sucks, but I almost would have liked to see Mitt Romney win the last election just so that the Democrats would actually be anti-war again and we'd be talking about the wars, you know. But no, we got Bush's fourth term under Obama, and they're still fucking silent. You know, that kind of hypocrisy is just disgusting and is dangerous. And, you know, we got to stand on principle and just whatever it is, stand on principle, you know. And I think that's a very key point. And let's get this out of the way and then bring on some callers. Tex, we got Chris Wallace asked, you know, as all these, you know, dipshits on TV always have to do, asked Rand Paul about 2016. I mean, you know, really, do we have to discuss that? But he brought it up, so let's hear Rand Paul on that so that we can put that puppy to bed and move on to important things. But here's Rand Paul responding to Chris Wallace, who I'm still a little pissed at for the way he treated both Newt and Paul in the last primary. But let's just listen. It's about a minute 30.
Finally, let's talk about 2016. How serious are you about running for, you know what I'm going to ask, how serious are you about running for president? And would it be to make a point, as your father did in his presidential runs, or would it be to win?
I would absolutely not run unless it were to win. Points have been made, and we'll continue to make points, but I think the country really is ready for the narrative coming, libertarian Republican narrative, also because we've been losing as a national party. We're doing fine in congressional seats, but we're becoming less and less of a national party because we don't win on the West Coast. We don't win in New England. We really struggled all around the Great Lakes. I think people want a party that's a little bit less aggressive on foreign policy, still believes in a strong national defense, but less aggressive. They want the young people want politicians who don't want to put them in jail for 20 years for a nonviolent drug possession charge. So they want a little bit different face. I think people want a little different face on immigration, frankly. They don't want somebody who wants to round people up, put them in camps, and send them back to Mexico.
Senator
Paul,
they
don't want to give them welfare either. I don't.
Senator
Excuse
Paul,
me?
We got 30 seconds left. You sound like you're running.
We won't make a decision until 2014, but I think I do want the party to become a national party again and not lose sight of how we grow as a party. So I will continue in that vein for a couple years, and then we'll decide.
Senator.
Well, there you have it, Tex. I don't know if you had a chance to catch up, but, you know, what are your thoughts on how he handled that annoying question?
I think he handled it pretty well. It is an annoying question and stupid, but, you know, the thing is, I think the news anchors themselves know that they're stupid questions. They just get kind of foisted upon them. Of course, maybe they're trying to create some news on their own. But it's a ridiculous question, kind of stupid, and it's always designed to put the person, the question's being asked to in an awkward position. And, of course, the response always sounds awkward, which that sounded. There's a million sound clips you can play of other people who may or may not have presidential aspirations being asked a version of the same question with the same sort of awkward response. But Chris Wallace also went on to ask Lindsey Graham about the hopes of Chuck Hagel, his nomination. Also Brennan, who's up for CIA director, and Rand Paul said that he wanted to block that nomination. And one of the things that he's trying to block Brennan's nomination over is this issue of drone strikes. And so Chris Wallace asked Lindsey Graham, and we're talking about the issue of drone strikes on Americans on U.S. soil, and
yep.
Brennan dodged the question, which should just automatically, in your mind, that should be a red flag if they won't answer the question. You know,
yeah.
They're dodging it. You know, it is kind of an issue of, hey, the government's decided that you're our problem, and so now we're going to use a predator drone with a Hellfire missile and kill you. Now, maybe they're not planning to do that at all, and maybe it's all overblown, but wouldn't a confirmation hearing be a good time for the person up for that job to say, you know, this issue has been overblown. This is not a problem. This is what we're actually talking about doing, and nobody's going to do that sort of stuff. But instead, he dodged the answer. That's the worst thing you could do.
Yep.
But so Chris Wallace asked Lindsey Graham about it, and Lindsey Graham, Rhino, said that I think the worst thing in the world is to have courts decide who to target in the war on terror.
Hello.
We're talking about American citizens inside the border. We have a right to a trial. We have a right to a trial by jury. You know, we have due process. Let's not have the courts decide who the government gets to kill, which of its citizens the government just singles out to kill with a missile. You know,
yeah.
I think the courts absolutely have a role. It's written into the Constitution, and how Lindsey Graham can give that answer is just completely beyond me. And the scary thing is it doesn't even raise an eyebrow in terms of what they're talking about.
Because everybody thinks everybody else is the terrorist, not them. Wait until you're the terrorist. you might change your mind.
now he did qualify it by saying we do need drones to patrol our borders. Okay, that's fine. You know, that's one thing. But I don't think you need a drone to attack an Al-Qaeda operative inside the United States. Okay, I don't think you need one. But did he say he's against it? That's something I would not support, and I really want to hear John Brennan's response to that because there's no way I would approve it. But it says it's a wishy-washy answer. And so in the face of a wishy-washy answer, you got to believe he's wishy-washy on the issue.
Yep.
Because he said, I've got a
five-minute clip with Rand Paul responding about, you know, talking about that drone stuff, but we got 45 minutes of live time left, so maybe we'll play that and discuss it slightly in overtime. I think you nailed it. And I mean, the thing is that, you know, I think we're over focusing on the drones. I mean, you know, the discussion is all about the drones. I'm like, you know what? A drone is like, you know, another weapon. It's another tool. Okay. I don't care if you want to use a drone or not use a drone. If it's the best tool for the job, use the drone. The issue is not the drone. The issue is the fact that you're targeting Americans without due process. Now, it's one thing if a police officer is driving by LaGuardia Airport and he sees a guy with an RPG aiming it at, you know, the next 747 that's landing there, and he decides to blow him away without due process. That's okay. He's in the commission of a crime that could take out the lives of 600 people. He gets shot. And I don't care if he's an American citizen, an illegal alien, whoever it is. But here we're talking about, you know, intel, where you could send a human being in to at least attempt to apprehend the person to get more intel, or at least give them due process and find out if they are actually guilty of the crime they're being accused of. But a drone can't apprehend anybody. It can only spy on you or kill you. So that's kind of a problem.
Yeah.
And speaking of people that are targeted by drones, we have a caller on the line, one of our frequent guests, from Coalition of Freedom, and I've got a new intro teed up for him. Here's the intro. And Trog, you are live with Tex and Rex.
Welcome to the show,
okay.
Trog.
Well, hey guys, what was the word? Something to do with a caveman or something?
Yes, Captain Caveman.
Oh, okay. Captain K, man, funny. You know, if there are drones targeting me, it's because I hang out with you guys. Yeah. So
look up to the skies, man.
No, this is a great conversation, and we've actually had a lot of posts on this because I did profile it and got into comments and conversations. But something you said earlier, you know, was important because, you know, we have all of us have said, and I say this continually, that, you know, it's 2014 first and then 2016 because, you know, we have no idea what our country is going to look like in 2014 or what the American public are going to be sick of and finally ready to do. But I believe, you know, and one of the reasons I've been watching and participating in this Rubio Rand little, you know, battle that's going on in the news, you know, mainstream media, is that it doesn't just define 2016, it also defines what's going on in the GOP. And that is that battle between the grassroots and the establishment. And I've said this before, you know, I did some research background on Rubio and you know, I know that Jeb Bush went out there and found him and built him and shaped him and, you know, backed him and everything else, you know, but he also has a pretty good voting record. And you know, he came in on the Tea Party wave. Yeah, I know he's not, you know, people would argue he's not the, you know, the real deal. But the thing is that one thing when I look at Rand, you know, and I hear the criticisms from the pure Ron Paulers, you know, he's not his dad. Well, good. You know, maybe he'll actually get elected. You know, I mean, I love Ron Paul in many ways, you know, in terms of the things that he's brought to the conversation, the Fed, you know, the issue about, you know, I never knew how many damn bases we had around the country, around the world, you know what I mean, until I started researching Ron Paul. And then I'm like, holy crap, what are we doing? You know, so we've learned a lot from Ron Paul. But one thing I find about Rand is he's very articulate and he's very balanced in the way he speaks and explains things. And you get what he's talking about very, very easily. You know, so I think that the battle that we're seeing, and it's kind of fun to watch because, yeah, 2016 is down the road, and who knows if we'll be America in 2016 or not, but or 2015 when the primary starts, because it takes a year. But I really think it's reflective of the battle that's going on in the party because they're trying to shove Rubio's down everybody's throat. I mean, how many people have said Rubio is the greatest speaker since Ronald Reagan? I've heard that about a half a dozen times. I'm going, really? You know, and yeah, you know, he's a pretty nice guy and he has a pretty good voting record and he looks good and he's out there and he's, you know, got the Hispanic, you know, thing going for him and all that stuff. But, you know, he is still a Bushman. And unless he can, you know, get up and separate himself from that, you know, you are who backs you. You know, that's the bottom line.
Just to qualify, when you say he's a Bushman, you're not saying that he's from the Kalahari Desert or that he likes women that are hirsute. You know, he doesn't like hirsute women. You're saying he's involved with the Bush pseudo monarchy family of the presidency.
Yeah, that was pretty funny. I guess that might have sounded weird to somebody who doesn't know what we're talking about. But yeah, no kidding. But, you know, yeah, I mean, Jeb Bush, I mean, you do the research and you figure out that, you know, this guy was identified a long time ago and he was hand-carried through the process. I'm not saying he's a bad guy because I don't see that in him yet. You know what I'm saying? He's still young.
Yeah, Chris.
But there's something that bugs me about the fact that, you know, Jeb Bush is his controller. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, yeah, and what I would say about that, Chris, is that, yeah, I mean, the reason to be concerned is not because I think he's necessarily a bad guy. I mean, he comes across as honest and sincere, and I think he truly believes what he's saying. What concerns me is he's being groomed and he's being handled.
Yep.
And he's sort of going along with it. Well, not sort of. He is going along with it. And that is one of the things that they look for, is how malleable is this person? Is this someone we can work with in the long run? And that's how you end up with rhinos. Because
well, I think
the person is too malleable. Okay.
I think he's more than malleable, Tex. I agree with you 100%. He is malleable, but let's point something out. I remember back in the Florida primaries, Newt gave a Spanish language statement about immigration in one of his ads, and then Romney came back and accused him of some major problems with that, and Rubio came out and chastised Newt and supported Romney. Now, Rubio, allegedly, is a Spanish speaker, so he could have heard it firsthand. He didn't have to rely on Romney's mistranslation. Yet he came out and supported Mitt Romney's mistranslation against Newt. Okay? He knows that that's not what Newt said because he speaks Spanish. So I have a problem with that because that shows a lack of character. So I think he's more than malleable. I think that he's ambitious. And you've said it many times, Tex, you know, about we don't want a man who wants the office, right? Maybe you want to give people a little background on that right now. But I think this guy wants it. I think he's ambitious. Sorry, I just wanted to throw that in there. Back to you.
Yeah, well, they say Caesar was ambitious. What the whole purpose of the Electoral College was that the person shouldn't seek the office, or as they said, the man should not seek the office because society was a bit different back then. But the office should find the man, and that was the job of the Electoral College, which was
that wise people would come together and find the person who had the best interests of the country at heart, and they would go find him or her and put them in the office. And there was, you know, the concept of going out and campaigning for office was viewed as bad because it meant that she wanted it, and there's something wrong with wanting a job that's that powerful. It says something about your character and who you are. So people who wanted the office should essentially be avoided unless they, you know, had some extra virtues or something that everyone else saw in them that made it acceptable. But, yeah, you know, he's a senator. He comes up. He wins this upset victory. People like him. Oh, my God, he's Cuban. He could appeal to Hispanics. We have a big Hispanic problem in this party. And so we'll run him as presidential candidate. They come, they talk to him. It certainly sounds like an enticing deal when he gets to the Senate. Oh, my God, I just got here. Hey, how'd you like to be president? Well, you know, geez, I don't know, I just got here. This seems like a pretty sweet deal so far. So, yeah, we're like, okay, we'll stick with us. We'll groom you and do what we say, and we'll put words in your mouth. And, you know, both ways we tell you to vote, which, you know, he's got a good voting record and everything. But how much of that is his personal opinion and how
strategy.
Much of that is handling? Yeah.
Yeah.
Much of that is strategy. You don't
mm-hmm.
know. But I do know that I don't trust the rhinos. And so I don't, when the rhinos pick someone, I instantly don't trust that person. Not because I think there's something inherently bad about them. I just don't like the people behind them because they've been screwing this party over for over a decade or more.
Can I add something? Oh, I'm sorry.
Sure. Go ahead.
No, I just wanted to add something because you said the Cuban connection, and I've written on this before, saying, you know, Cuba, the issues that the Mexicans have with, you know, the Republican Party and trying to find a place in this country, the Cubans haven't had that problem because 99% of them are political refugees. You know, they haven't gone through the same process that the average, you know, Mexican coming or South American coming trying to get into this country has. So it's interesting to me that they look at Marco as their solution to the Hispanic issue because he's Cuban, he's not Mexican. There is a difference there. I know maybe, you know, the GOP who doesn't understand minorities may not understand that. but I do, and I've done research on it. They're not chummy.
Chris, I think the GOP understands minorities very well because they are the minority, and they're becoming more minor every day.
I just had to slide that in, though. You know what I mean? It was just...
No, it's a good point. I mean, I think the Cuban experience. I mean, the refugees there dealt firsthand with exactly the kind of regime that Obama is trying to force upon us, and it is different. But I think that this is where the current Republican line is just completely way off base. You know, Cubans, Mexicans, OTMs, which is, you know, other than Mexicans, that's how the Border Patrol classifies them when they come across the southern border and they're not from
OTM.
Mexico. Other than Mexicans. It's actually, it's a technical term because, you know, let's be clear about something. Our porous border isn't simply about Mexicans coming here to stand on your street corner so they can hang some sheetrock, okay? You've got, you know, Al-Qaeda, Hezbollah, you've got, you know, drug cartels, Zetas, MS-13. You got all sorts of shit crossing the border. So it's not just about, you know, the guy I know who just wants to come over here, hang some sheetrock, and send some money back home. So, you know, it is a serious issue.
Yeah, if that's
issue,
all we had, we'd have half the problem.
Yeah, exactly. So you know, but the fact is that, you know, what the real question of the Republican Party and specifically conservatives, whether they're in the party or not, have to ask is how do you appeal to a broader audience? Do you have to appeal to them? And we talked about this in the beginning a little bit. Do you have to appeal to them based on their, you know, their genitals or their skin color or their ethnic background or their, you know, cultural identity? Or do you appeal to them on the fact that in this country everybody has equal dignity before the law, equal opportunity, okay, and the freedom to determine their own destiny? Now, that is something that's attractive to everybody except for those that don't want to carry their own weight. And let's face it, if you're $16 trillion in debt, we really don't want to invite more people here who don't want to carry their own weight. We've got plenty of them here already. They were born here. They're not even illegal, okay? So that message of equal dignity before the law, equal opportunity, and the right to determine your own destiny, that appeals to everybody, irrespective of their background, because then you can live your life as you think it's best, not as the government bureaucrats tell you to live it, or at the expense of somebody else. You know, so I think that the message has to be broader than trying to appeal to people on their, you know, physical identity. Go ahead, Tex.
Yeah, and one of the other reasons that I'm slightly suspicious of Marco Rubio's candidacy, if not the man himself, is there's another Cuban American out there, a senator who won an upset victory, and his name's Ted Cruz down here in Texas. And if anything, a lot of what you hear in the media, and I think Republicans are sort of trying to figure out what to do with Ted Cruz, but it's not automatically glowing because Bushes were behind David Dewhurst, who was lieutenant governor down here. And Cruz upset the victory because he was viewed as more conservative and in line with what the people of Texas wanted. And so the Bush machine is not necessarily happy about the fact that Ted Cruz won, but he's also the son of Cuban-American immigrants. So he fits the profile that they're looking for, if indeed that is the profile that they're looking for, and they're not lying to you, and the real profile that they're looking for is Rhino, not someone with, you know, Latin American background. And that, I think, is the truth. They don't really care if you have a Latin American background. They don't really care if you're black. They don't really care if you're a female. Just look at all the minority candidates that we've had in this party that they've gotten rid of. What they care about is whether or not you're a Rhino. And so automatically, anyone who's embraced by the party or the party leadership, in my opinion, is instantly suspect, because it means they meet one critical criteria. Either they are a Rhino, or they're malleable enough that they will go along with it anyway.
I mean, you just nailed the problem right there. That's exactly
right.
It. Look, you know, it's the same issue for the party on a national scale with the races that they're running and the victories that they keep destroying, as well as, you know, the personal politics of each individual. If you win at any cost by saying anything and being anything and trying to be all things to all people, then what did you win? You know, I mean, if the Republican Party manages to gain more seats in the House and the Senate in 2014 and then win the presidency in 2016, but they won it with guys who ostensibly are going to give us Bush's, what would it be, fifth term? Except that this time, instead of under a Democrat, it'll be under a Republican. What did you win? You know, when they're sitting here whining and bitching about a forced cut of $85 billion, and let's do the numbers, okay? A billion is 1,000 million, and a trillion is 1,000,000 million, okay? A $3.7 trillion, that's 3.7 thousand million-dollar budget that's about to have 85 thousand million cut out of it. That's nothing. If they don't have the guts to do more than that,
I don't know.
Then who cares if they win? What's that?
I don't know if that made it more clear or not.
All right, let's look at it this way.
You're
$370,000 in debt, or you're running a company and it spends $370,000 a year. Okay, you're going to cut 8,500 out of that and think that somehow that's going to make a huge difference? It's not. It's not going to make a difference at all. It's such a drop in the bucket that it won't swing things one way or the other. We're talking about gigantic numbers, but as far as a percentage goes, this dangerous sequester that's going to put us all in danger and destroy our defense structure is nothing. If they don't have let's face it. Right now, helicopter Ben Bernanke is throwing, as far as we know, since we can't freaking audit the Fed, $85 billion a month into the economy, fabricated out of nothing, based on nothing. That's $1 trillion a year. Okay, so the government takes in somewhere around 2.4, 2.5 trillion in taxes, and they're spending 3.7. Where do you think that shortfall is being made up? Ben is just printing up the fucking money, which is just reducing your wealth by, you know, 25-30%. You know, you can't keep doing that. You actually need to cut. What we should be cutting right now is $1 trillion out of the budget this year. Out of the budget this year. I know that, you know, Paul Ryan, that great budget cutter, numbers guy, superstar of the Republican Party, wants to cut $600 billion out over 10 years. That's nothing. You need to cut $1 trillion out this year. Oh, but everything will be destroyed if we do that. No, it won't. No, it won't. Half the stuff that they spend money. I mean, do you really need to spend $10 million of debt or taxpayer money to find out the effects of you know, alcohol on prostitutes in China? I mean, is that really something that we need to be doing? That's insane.
Well,
or, you know, putting a shrimp on a fucking treadmill?
Well, now that we've had the State of the Union, they're talking about increasing spending and everything. The media is out there talking about, well, infrastructure. The debt is $16 trillion. You don't have – do you have $16 trillion worth of roads out there? I mean, come on. These things made of gold. It's not – everything's not going to infrastructure. You know, it's going to all these entitlement spendings, which are just pass-through taxation where they take your money and they give it to somebody else. That's what it's going for, not infrastructure, but that's the first thing they hide behind. It's, oh, we build the roads. You know, well, hey, guess what? Down here in Texas, all of a sudden, Rick Perry decided, oh, we're not going to take any federal highway dollars because I don't believe in welfare. Well, that's not welfare, idiot. They took our money from Texas up to the federal government, and we're asking for it back to build roads. So what they did is they built toll roads. So now if you drive anywhere down here, you're paying money for it. And now they're saying, oh, well, Obama needs all this extra money so that we can build infrastructure and roads, and nobody talks about that because you just take it for granted that it's free. Well, not down here anymore. Freaking pay for it every day. Drive around, you know, Houston, Austin, you're on a toll road. So what's Obama need his money for? Because we're paying for our own roads down here.
Well, you know, there's two things about you said roads that just pops up into my head. I mean, you know, you're right. And the fact is that the Constitution does provide for the federal government to be involved in roads. Okay, post roads is, I believe, what it specifically states. Here's the thing, though. Just because the Constitution says that it can, it doesn't say that it has to. And one of the old lies that we always hear, if there was no government, we wouldn't have roads. Come on. I mean, does anybody really believe? Do you really think that Walmart is going to set up shop and say, oh, shit, no one's coming because there's no roads? I mean, they're going to build a fucking road, okay? I mean, you know, if McDonald's has a drive-in, they want you to show up, they're going to put it on a road that exists, or they're going to build a road in order to get you to go there. So that's just stupid. And the fact is everybody says, well, we need to tax people because we have to have roads. Not a single road in this country has ever been built and paid for with tax dollars. Tax revenues, current tax revenues. All the roads are built by debt, principally bonds, municipal bonds and federal bonds. So that's debt that puts you in hocks, so you have to service it with the interest, which is where your income taxes goes, and your children's 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 children. Okay, that's the fundamental problem. The government has to do what it's called to do. There are some things that it is basically ordered to do, and then there are other things that it can do if necessary, and then there are some things it cannot do. One of the things that it cannot do is spend more than it has, except in times of real extreme emergencies. And an undefined, non-geographically specified war on a tactic is not one of the things it should be spending money on. And I am specifically, you know, referring to the so-called war on terror. I mean, what the hell is that? You know, let's be clear who we're at war with and where it is and how you're going to win it and get out. And then, you know, delineate a certain amount of money you're going to spend and how much blood you're willing to risk for this objective. But other than that, you can't just be spending money on this so-called security defense network that is really nothing more than a police state. Now, let's be clear. That doesn't mean that your soldiers, your people who work in the Pentagon, DOD, or DHS, or anything, are bad people. In fact, I would argue most of them probably went there because they felt called to do something to help the country. But you have to understand something, that once you give government this tool, with the best intentions, it can be used for the wrong purposes. And as we've talked about a million times, the nature of power is to seek more power, and the nature of corrupt men is to seek places where they get power and gain more power. And that's precisely why the Founding Fathers set up a system that uses our own vices against our own vices. And Texas said it a million times. The Constitution sets up and uses power to check power. And so you can't tip that balance by spending all this money in order to give the government more power. What Marco Rubio did was bitch about the fact that Obama has that power and whine that the Republicans don't. What Rand Paul said was, this power doesn't belong to government. Now, you have to ask yourself, and I'm not talking, you know, I don't want to talk about 2016, but if you had two choices, you had two men who were running in 2016 for the most powerful, you know, position on the planet, and one of them is basically saying, well, the problem with this guy is that he's not on our team, and, you know, we had defeats, and I want that power back. Or do you want a guy who says, hey, you know what, no one should have this power? That's the decision you're making. And the Republicans overwhelmingly right now are basically just saying, woe is me, we've lost, we want the power back, we want to go back to the good old Bush years, okay, as opposed to saying, wow, we really lost our way. We violated what Reagan did and was working towards by electing, you know, eat my shorts, H.W. Bush. And then Gingrich reminded us what Reagan was doing and actually started moving us in the right direction. Granted, he didn't really balance the budgets. He reduced the growth. Okay, that's a fact. But the fact is that those four, quote, balanced budgets are the closest things you've seen to a balanced budget in, you know, 60, 70 years. Okay. Yeah. So that's a step in the right direction. And what was the Republican Party's response to what Gingrich did? We got to get rid of this guy. We need to get rid of him immediately. And they get rid of him. And then what do? They go on a compassionate spending spree. Okay. And what Ron Paul has done with the Liberty Movement, and what Rand Paul is now speaking to, is, hey guys, we can't keep doing this. We need to go back to what the message of Goldwater, Reagan, Gingrich, and my dad was, what the real Republican message is. And when we say that, it's still the message that's in the Republican Party platform. Well, if I can't trust you to follow your platform, I can't trust you to respect the Constitution, then I don't really want your victory because you're worse than the other guys, because at least the other guys have declared to be the enemy of conservatism. You're saying you're the champions of it, and in fact, all you're doing is the same crap as the other guys, but you're just whining and bitching because you're not the ones that get to do it now. That's how I see it.
Well, that's absolutely the problem.
Oh, go ahead. Go ahead, Ted.
Go ahead, Chris.
Well, I was just going to chime in, and you know, I've said this 1,000 times, is that until Republicans get honest about the Bush era, we're going to continue to lose this war. Because when you look at, you know, people go, how did Obama run against Bush again? Well, he did. It was simple. All the people in power in Congress in the Republican Party are Bush rhinos. They are the leftovers that were part of that era that gave us, you know, the first five major debt ceiling increases, the first record borrowing increase in the history of our country, the endless wars, the war on terror, the Patriot Act, the TSA, Homeland Security, the FEMA camps, all that stuff, you know, that we're bitching about, you know, with Obama, that everybody's all of a sudden scared to death with, Bush gave it to us. And until Republicans get this message and understand this, they will continue to lose. And when we talk about 2014 and the battle, you know, the Roe issue and Boehner and you know, some of the spinoff on Rubio, which, like I said, I don't know how to totally judge him yet, you know, because I'm, you know, we're still watching him. But when I look at who his handlers are, you know, I don't like it. I like Rubio. I like his record. You know what I'm saying? All those kind of wonderful things. But the distrust is there because of the foundation of the people behind him. That era, until those people are replaced, we will continue to lose. Because look what Boehner and Cantor and Ryan, you know, you talked about Paul Ryan earlier. Everybody thought he was some great, you know, he's the numbers guru. What he proposed was a joke, you know, a 10-year joke. If a Democrat would have brought his platform to a Republican Congress 10 years ago, they would have been laughed out of the chamber. And we're praising him like he brought some great change and solution to our country. It was nothing. It was an embarrassment. So we've had nothing. First we had the Bush era. Then we have the last 2 years of Boehner and Cantor and the rest of them. And McCain, do you see him in that State of the Union? You know, after, you know, the praise he got and how he was just giggling and all over himself, and he had Schumer next to him, and they were grinning at him, and, yeah, John, you just got mentioned. And I'm thinking, you got to be kidding me. People need to get this.
That was awful. It wasn't as bad as Biden and Boehner playing footsies, though. That was disgusting.
or something.
Yeah, Chris, no, you're right. And I mean, why do they do this? They got to find their next appealing guy. You know, it was Paul Ryan, and they thought that, you know, they could dress up Mitt Romney with Paul Ryan, and conservatives would be like, oh, okay, well, that's good. You know, we have a conservative vice president, the most useless job in Washington, D.C., unless there's a tie in the Senate, and so we can vote for the rhino because there's a conservative, allegedly, vice president. You know, and then, well, that didn't work. Shit, they caught on to us. What can we do next? Hey, how about the Latin guy? Let's get Marco Rubio up there. We'll give him the SOTU, you know, response and all this kind of stuff. But the reason they do this stuff is because otherwise they have to run around and admit the truth, which is, you know, that...
Now what the fuck are we supposed to do? We're some real pretty shit now, man!
Well, I know what you're supposed to do. Listen to Ron Paul. Go ahead, Dex.
Yeah. I mean, this is the thing about John McCain, is that, he got all this praise because he works across the aisle. He's in the center. That's good. He's a good Republican. You know, we like this kind of Republican and everything. And then he runs for president, and like, oh, John McCain's terrible. He's awful. He's old. You know, all these negative things, and the press turns on him. But now that he's not a threat and he's back in the pocket where he's basically ineffective in the role really of just assassinating other Republicans who are trying to do conservative things, well, let's go praise John McCain now because he's basically useless. He's our, you know, our model Republican who goes along with everything that we want. He goes after those mean conservatives who try to stop the Democrat agenda. But as soon as you stand up and start doing something, they'll come gunning for you. So John McCain really is an illuminating case of how the left treats Republicans, which is why I thought Marco Rubio's speech, which I am certain, I guarantee, the RNC and high-ranking members of the Republican Party had a hand in making sure that that was crafted in the way that they wanted, came off as an apology and is very defensive because that's what they like. That's what they think you need. Well, that's not how you win. People don't vote for people who are defensive. They vote for somebody out there who's standing up for a vision where they want to take the country, and people find that compelling, and they go follow that person. They don't worry about all the negative press about it. What they worry about, or what they think about, is the positive vision of the future and how they identify with it and they rally behind it, and then they begin to defend it against all the negative attacks.
Yep.
Rather than starting off, hey, I get negatively attacked when I say these things, I think that's unfair, but I won't say my vision because they'll probably attack that. Well, you're never going to win that way.
If your skin is that thin, you're in the wrong business. You know, and the fact is that this amazing desire to avoid controversy and always apologize for taking the wrong position because you don't have any principles, it's exactly what gave us, you know, the whole read my lips crap. I mean, well, here, let's play a little montage. We'll start with Bush the Elder.
Raise taxes and I'll say no, and they'll push and I'll say no, and they'll push again and I'll say to them, read my lips.
And then we got, you know, Bush Jr.
have abandoned free market principles to save the free market system.
And then, you know, we've got that useless piece of beef jerky.
And I'm committed to working with members of both parties to cut our deficits and debt. But we can't simply cut our way to prosperity.
But, as I've said before, we can't just cut our way to prosperity.
At some point, we're going to have to address the spending problem that we have. But we can't cut our way to prosperity. We need real economic growth.
I mean, look at that. You know, you've got the two Bush idiots that are saying things that are absolutely 100%, you know, not conservative. When you say no new taxes and then you raise taxes, well, you're not trustworthy and you're not conservative. When you say I've abandoned the free market to save the free market, you're not only not conservative, you're quite possibly a fucking idiot. And then when Boehner sounds exactly like Obama, I mean, that's what we've come to. Where the guy in charge of the purse is allegedly the conservative Republican sounds exactly like the guy who wants to spend the purse who's a socialist Democrat, you got a problem. And the only person I heard this week mention it is Rand Paul.
Yep.
Well, and
I hate to say that.
Keynesianism doesn't work, but they don't know if they're not willing to try what does work. They're not willing to go over to the Austrian school of economics. They're not willing to return to the free market. How did America happen? How did it grow and make this, you know, 5,000-year leap from where other countries were in such a short period of time? Well, it unleashed the power of the free market, and government stepped in. Well, actually, big government or big corporations themselves stepped in to enforce regulations to limit competition because they had theirs, and they wanted to make sure that others didn't get advantage at their expense. And so now they're putting a lid on the free economy. They're going this Keynesian direction, and they know Keynesianism doesn't work, but it does seem to be pretty good for the people at the top who work for the government, and so they don't have an alternate philosophy to go with. That's part of the problem.
That's a huge part of the problem.
Therefore, you have Republicans who are going along with what Obama's doing because, you know, as Nixon said, we're all Keynesians now.
Yeah.
And Nixon should know because he set us up for it.
Yeah, exactly.
And sometimes I think we give the president way too much credit. I mean, there, you know, he's one person. There's usually others behind him. I mean, when you say Obama, you know, you're really talking about Valerie Jarrett and Van Jones and all the other commie pinko bastards. When you're talking about, you know, Bush, you know, it was Rove and all the other neocons. So it's you know, Nixon was managed by Kissinger. I mean, come on, you know, let's be clear about something. But just so that we do a little housekeeping, we're in the last 8 minutes of live show. I got one caller who's been on for a while from area code 704. I'm going to bring you on shortly. Won't be able to bring on any other callers, but if you want to listen, because we are going to spill over into overtime a little bit, we're going to also listen to Rand Paul talking about the drones and such. If you want to listen, call in within the next 8 minutes, or you will have to catch us in archives. Call in number 646-649-1013. I'm going to throw it to my co-host and then Chris for final thoughts on where we are right now, and then we'll bring in the caller and then go to Rand Paul. So text to you.
Well, where we are right now is caught between where – wrapped up in the civil war within the Republican Party, and we've got to figure out where this party is going to go and what it actually stands for. And we have to be able to identify who's on our side, who's not on our side, and who the establishment wants to put up as the people who supposedly speak for us, because they've done this time and time again. And as we know, when they get to power, they actually don't speak for us. They start doing the exact opposite of what we want, which is really what the problem is. And so you have to identify the people that they don't like and that they start disparaging and say, oh, well, I think that's radical. That's too, you know, that's inflammatory or whatever. Okay, we'll find those people, because the vast majority of Americans don't think this country is heading in the right direction. They want to see a new direction. And so you need to find the people, find the firebrands, because the firebrands are the people who are going to change things. If you like the way things are going, find the guys who aren't going to rock the boat. And the party is trying to put forward, or the party leadership is trying to put forward, people who aren't going to rock the boat. Well, those aren't the people who are going to affect the change that the American people want. And so stop supporting those guys and find the, you know, the troublemakers. Find the people who are rocking the boat.
Chris, to you.
So back to
yes,
you.
Yes, sir. I totally agree. I mean, I agree with a lot. Just about everything you guys say anyway. I think the important thing to understand is it goes back to that and people need to listen to that show that you did that I helped you with on the I call it the Republicans of Christmas past is how I define it. But when you look at the core of this party and you look at the early presidents, they were very Ron Paulian in a lot of ways. And I'm not saying 100% down the line. I'd have to do more research on that. But when you look at what Rand Paul is saying, he's speaking the changes that must be done, that need to be done if you're going to turn this country around. That's going to resonate with a lot more people than the generic Republican, i.e. Paul Liberty Movement, libertarians, and people who believe there needs to be a change. That message, and I'm not, you know, promoting him for 2016, that's his call. But the message is there, and that is the message of change that needs to be addressed, and that is recognizing that both parties are at fault. I mean, who would have ever thought we would have been in a situation that we are today where the Democrats are no longer attacking war 24/7, 7 days a week, like they do when Bush got us into the wars. But, I mean, it is amazing now that Obama's there. I mean, he's got the record for drone kills, and, you know, he's having a good old time, you know, with all this power and stuff like that and starting wars and, you know, giving power to the UN to, you know, take out another dictator. And, I mean, it is, you know, people have said, I've said this before, you got to understand there's a difference between a liberal, you know, 60s hippie liberal anti-war and a Marxist, because Marxists love to kill. They love battles. They love power. And so we are at a precipice where these Republicans that are in power in the House and Senate, they're Democrats. You know, I mean, absolutely, people have got to get this through their brain, because we need a fresh voice. Ron Paul started that revolution and has educated many of us. You know, I've learned a lot, you know, studying the man and his message. And so yep. When I see this response to SOTA, you know, to the State of the Union, you know, I'm not looking necessarily right at the person saying it, because, like I say, 2016 is a long ways away. You got to look at the message. That is the fresh. That is the change. That is the trillion-dollar cut that is needed today. And it's going to, and it has to be addressed to both parties, because they're in bed together, period, end of report. That's my input.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think you've nailed it. The fact is that, do a little housekeeping with it too, but, you know, Tex and Rex, and, you know, Chris, we met you around the convention time, but you too, and Ron Paul, we told you this was going to happen. We saw it coming, and, you know, you didn't want to listen. Well, you know, we turned out to be right. And, you know, Ron Paul has told us a lot of things that were going to happen based on, you know, ontological consequences that are just going to happen. I mean, you know, if you do X, you get Y, and, you know, you don't want to listen. Well, that's where you get where you are. But I would say that Ron Paul, I mean, you know, he's been doing the work, and people want to attribute these things to him. And I'm not going to take away anything from what he's taught us or at least brought back into fashion, but Ron Paul is merely echoing Thomas Jefferson and the Austrian economists, principally, you know, Mises, Hayek, and Rothbard. So, you know, this isn't, you know, unique to Ron Paul, and the fact that Ron Paul is now going to go on a college speaking tour to get more young people involved doesn't mean that, you know, oh, we've lost Ron Paul. What the fuck are we going to do? It's not about Ron Paul. Never was, and he would be the first one to tell you that. And is Rand Paul exactly like him? No. But is he similar enough in principle to matter? Yes. The show that Chris referenced was our Tex and Rex's Conservative Christmas Carol, which you can catch in archives by going into Blog Talk Radio and searching for Tex and Rex and going to our page, and you can scroll down to all our archives. If you're listening to us on Blog Talk Radio right now, right under the show icon is a little button that says follow. If you click on that, you will receive notifications of when we are broadcasting in your Blog Talk Radio profile and affiliated email. On Facebook, you can like the Tex and Rex Show page, and you will get notifications whenever we're broadcasting. And feel free, if you want to discuss the articles and such and the links, join the Tex and Rex's Liberty Militia. On Blog Talk Radio, you can also find Chris, Coalition of Freedom. That's his radio show. And on Facebook, Coalition of Freedom is a working group building coalitions between people from different backgrounds who have commonality and love the Constitution and liberty. For those of you who haven't called in and are listening live, we are going to lose you. Please check us out in archives. And for the rest of you, stay on with us. We'll probably go somewhere around 20 or 30 more minutes. We do have one caller who's been here for a while, area code 704. I'm going to open your mic. You are live with Tex and Rex and Chris. What is on your mind regarding the dueling State of the Union responses that were given by Senators Rubio and Paul?
Well, hey, guys. This is Chuck Souter of ConstitutionalWar.org, and we love your show. We love what you're doing, man. And the first thing that I would like to say is I couldn't agree more with the sentiment about Rand or Rubio. Rand Paul is obviously taking the banner from Reagan, taking the banner from Goldwater, and applying that to a 21st century conservatism that cannot be tapped into by anybody other than somebody who is going to espouse these principles of liberty that our founding fathers had. I just watched a speech, and I don't know if you guys have seen it or not, of Stuart Rhodes up in New York, where he asked the county up there, are you guys a come-and-take-it county, or are you guys a bend-over-and-take-it county? And that's really and it's on the gun issue, and that's really the issue of what the Republican Party is going to be. Are we a come and take it party, or are we a bend over and take it party? Obviously, with people like Romney or McCain, we are a bend over and take it party. I, for one, think that Rand Paul is telling the feds, he's telling the country at large, he's saying, yeah, I'm running for president, but I don't even really care if I win. And to me, that says that he is saying to the states that you should be a come and take it state, and you should make up your own decisions. You shouldn't rely on the federal government. I don't know if you guys agree with me on that, but that's the way I'm seeing it. What Rubio is saying is, in my opinion, and no disrespect to Mr. Rubio, what Rubio is saying is the federal government is the supreme law of the land. The Supreme Court is the supreme law of the land. Whatever Washington, D.C. tells us is the supreme law of the land. We've got to make sure we fix Washington, D.C., because if we don't fix Washington, D.C., we're screwed. What? My response to that is, what's the point of even trying? We're screwed. If it comes down to Washington, D.C., fixing the problems or us being screwed, we're screwed.
Well, that gets back to what Rand Paul was saying, which is Congress can't really fix these problems. The American people have to demand that they be fixed, because the American people can change Congress and make sure that they do these things. But sitting around passively doing nothing has proven to be ineffective. The net effect of doing nothing is clearly nothing. And Washington is just going to grow. Power is just going to increasingly be centralized. And the American people need to stand up and do something, particularly at the local and state level, in order to affect change. Because if you can change that, then you can change the federal level. And the problem is all our problems right now, everybody thinks it has to go to the federal government to come up with a one-size-fits-all solution for all 50 states. Massachusetts was essentially a theocracy, when it came into, when it was a colony, there was a state religion. If you weren't part of the state religion, you couldn't be an office holder, and nobody had a problem with it because that was how that state was run, and if you didn't like that, you went to a different state, so you have 50 experiments in democracy. The problem is, imagine taking how Massachusetts used to be run back in the early days of the colony and then trying to apply it to the entire, 50 states now. That wouldn't go over very well.
Same thing with how, let's say, you know, the colony of Georgia or Rhode Island was run, and try to apply that to everybody. It wouldn't work. And that's the problem that we're having with the federal government right now, is the federal government's trying to come up with a solution that's going to fit everybody, when we have our own states, which are supposed to be sovereign states with a federal government that they created. That's the problem. You can't keep solving everything at the federal level, because the federal government, the power distance is too great, and it's not going to listen, because it doesn't care about you. At the federal level, you're one of 315 million. At the state level, you're one of a smaller population of people. At the local level, you know, you're one of an even smaller number of people. And how many people in your locality are actually participating? So if you start participating, well, there you go. You're in the elite of your community, the political elite of your community that affects the candidates who get on the ballots, that get selected for the state offices, and then later on the federal offices. So that's what's important, getting involved at the local level.
Yeah, no, I couldn't agree more. You've got to be involved at the local level, whether it's your, you know, becoming a precinct chairman, district, county, on up, all the way on up to state chairman of your party, or, you know, if you're not in the Republican Party, which is what I'm fighting for, is the Republican Party. Hey, look, I don't even like the Republican Party as founded. I'm not a fan. I think I've told you guys this before. I'm not a fan of Abraham Lincoln. I'm not a fan of I think every president, including our current president and our previous presidents, have pretty much all been products of what Lincoln wrought on the country. That's not what I want. That's not the, you know, when I look at Rand Paul, I look at him as somebody who would be transformative in the sense of as much so as Lincoln, but in a totally different direction, in a direction that actually gives more, acknowledges more rights of the states, and is going to allow things bad to happen, and not get rid of you know, certain protections that were written in the Magna Carta and our Constitution. We've got to be willing to take something as bad as 9/11. To take something as bad as Pearl Harbor and not give up on the founding principles that our founding fathers get to us. Look, we got to man up. People are going to, governments are going to do crazy things. Other nation states are going to do crazy things to us. And it's not a weak sign to not put people in internment camps like we did after World War II. To me, that's a sign of weakness. What is your opinion on that? I mean, can we not be strong and say, yeah, we got really railroaded by these guys on 9/11 or these guys in Pearl Harbor, but we're going to show our strength. We'll show our strength by upholding our principles of freedom and liberty and individual rights, and not putting people in internment camps is how we show our strength. Or do we show our strength by doing what we did to the Japanese during World War II and the Germans?
Well, I have ancestors of German descent that were, you know, here in the U.S. during World War I, and wasn't necessarily a very pleasant experience. Part of the problem with internment camps during World War II is it was just a blanket, you're Japanese and therefore you're guilty of being a collaborationist. So I don't think that's really a model you want to emulate. But if there are people who are working with the enemy, you know, so sort of Al-Qaeda sleeper cells or you know, otherwise people who are aiding and abetting the enemy or something, yeah, I mean, those people you need to identify who they are and go and gather them up. So I don't think, you know, kind of a hands-off policy with the extent of those people is going to impress anyone. But I would be careful about just saying, oh, well, you know, you fit into this category, therefore you're guilty until proven innocent, particularly if you're talking about American citizens, because American citizens are all innocent until proven guilty. But, you know, there are always going to be people who are working with the enemy or people who are bad actors. You need to identify those people and then, you know, deal with them accordingly.
Oh, absolutely. And I wouldn't be opposed to just, you know, obviously if they're American citizens, they deserve a trial. But at the same time, if they are posing danger to our country, our Constitution, then they should be treated as such, and there's nothing wrong with killing them. I'm not opposed to,
yeah, that's sort of what was going on with people who were, you know, Nazi sympathizers during World War II or during any of our other wars who were, you know, operating in civilian clothing behind enemy lines. They essentially at that point were outside the Geneva Conventions, which we, you know, operate under today, but at the time didn't exist. And, you know, people who are outside of uniform, because there's a reason militaries wear uniforms, and that's so that you can identify who the targets are. These are the legitimate targets of war. That's why I'm wearing this uniform. So you know who I am, and you don't go after the civilians. Well, if somebody's in civilian clothes acting on behalf of the enemy, then they are essentially a spy or an enemy combatant or whatever, and, you know, those people get executed. People who are in uniform who get captured, usually they're exchanged. They do prisoner exchanges and that sort of thing. That's part of the rules of war. To the extent that war has rules, there are some that the West has agreed on, and that's one of the ones. If you're going to be on the other side, or if you're going to be fighting in the war, you wear a uniform so we know who you are. Okay, you're part of the opposing force, and therefore you're a legitimate target. But once you start changing clothes and start blending in with the civilian population, well, you're outside the rules of war. So that's basically a penalty, violation. They throw a flag on that. It's really what's going on.
Yeah, yeah, no, I completely agree with you, and I appreciate those points. I would just add on to that if we're going to have a war on terror, it's got to be a war on terror, not on ideas, in the sense that anybody who is going to defend themselves or going to do anything along those lines of looking for a way to express their anger, their frustration, their want for their own nation or whatever like that, what we've got to do is we've got to decide what it is so that we know what we're fighting and we don't go on and on and on and on. Now, if somebody is, what we've seen in Benghazi, that should be met with the most force that this country has. You can't allow stuff like that to go on. Should we have been there in the first place? I don't think so. But at the same time, we're already there, so we've got to do something. In my opinion.
Well, yeah, Chuck, and I think that foreign policy is one of those things that probably requires its own show, but let's kind of bring it back into the fold here regarding the Rubio rant thing. I've got a five-minute clip, and then we'll each take about 2 minutes to comment on it, and then we'll bring it on home. But I'm going to go ahead and mute the mics, and we're going to listen to Rand Paul the day after he gave the SOTU response, and I believe this is on CNN Out Front with some chick. I don't remember her name. But anyway, here it is. It's about 5 minutes.
Well, he didn't say no. What I want to hear from John Brennan before I agree to let his nomination go forward is that no, a CIA or the Department of Defense cannot kill someone in America without, you know, any kind of judicial proceeding. Senator Wyden asked Brennan this in the committee hearing. He says, can you kill an American on American soil with a drone without a judicial hearing? And Brennan didn't answer the question. So we've asked it in writing. My understanding is Senator Wyden has asked this in writing, and we don't have an answer. So if you're not going to answer no, I think that means you're essentially telling us, yes, you believe that the president has the power to kill an American in America. That is appalling. You know, I think even overseas, that if there is someone who's not in the middle of firing a gun or a grenade launcher,
right,
that they really should be tried for treason if they're an American citizen,
mm-hmm,
and then, you know, you can proceed on with drone attacks. But really, an American citizen should be tried and adjudicated in a court here or abroad unless they're
right,
imminently in the act of firing a weapon.
And when it comes to Hagel's nomination, obviously John McCain today indicating he may filibuster it, going against what he had said before. Tom Ricks is a contributing editor for Foreign Policy magazine. He was a special military correspondent for the Washington Post. He's written two books about Iraq, a lot of sources in the Pentagon, and he just wrote this about Chuck Hagel. Quote, his big problem is that no one much wants him running the Pentagon. The prospect of a Hagel regime at DOD is a real problem now because the next Secretary of Defense will need to do two things: work with Congress to reduce the defense budget thoughtfully, and work with the military to reshape the military to make it relevant for future conflict. At the moment, Hagel appears to lack the political capital to do the former and the intellectual appetite to do the latter. Those are very strong words. Do you think Chuck Hagel can run the Pentagon?
You know, my inclination has been, even though I'm a conservative Republican, to give the president the prerogative of deciding who's in his cabinet. I voted for John Kerry, even though politically I don't agree with much, if anything, that John Kerry represents as far as a U.S. senator. But I think he's an honest person, and I think the president has the right to decide. With regard to Hagel, my first inclination was to give him the benefit of the doubt. I'm for auditing the Pentagon. I think there is waste to be found, and I think he would be good at rooting that out. I think he's a soldier. He served honorably. He was wounded in combat. But I'm starting to have some doubts, and my doubts are that if you're going to run the Department of Defense, you really need to reveal if you've had financing from groups. There's all kinds of rumors all over the Internet about foreign groups that may have provided financing, and I think he needs to reveal that. And so I am one who's saying, yes, I do need a little more information before making a final decision.
All right. But do you think that John McCain is right to filibuster, given your point, that you may not like who the president picks, but it is fundamentally
right,
his prerogative whom he chooses to be in his cabinet?
Well, I think where we are with Hagel is the same place I am with Brennan. I want more information. If they're not going to give us the information, the only way to get the information is to threaten to hold them to a higher standard of 60 votes. So I think if people are not willing to give you information, for example, by Brennan not saying no, that he won't strike Americans in America, he's essentially saying yes, and that is very scary and worrisome to me, that you would strike Americans. Do you realize that we do signature strikes now? We don't even name the target of the people we kill with drones. If there's a line of traffic coming out of a camp, and we think that camp is populated by people who don't like America, we bomb them. Well, is that a high enough standard for Americans maybe coming out of a city or an encampment somewhere in the U.S. where they're meeting and saying anti-government things? Are we going to have signature strikes in America? I mean, it opens Pandora's box once you say you may well kill Americans in America without any judicial trial, with politicians making the decision. That's very worrisome.
Now, last night, of course, you issued the Tea Party response to the President's State of the Union address, and you took on Democrats, you also took on Republicans. But I have to ask you this, Senator, because last time around, in 2012, four of the 16 Senate candidates that were endorsed by the Tea Party, four, actually won. Is the Tea Party losing steam?
Well, we did better in 2010. We didn't do as well, but neither did any Republicans do very well in 2012. So I don't think that's necessarily fair. I would say that there still is a movement, but I still think that the Tea Party gives energy mostly to the Republican Party, but it's also equal parts chastisement to anybody who promotes big government or deficits. So the Tea Party's not afraid to tell Republicans you need to spend less money also.
And there you go. That was Rand Paul making some pretty awesome statements, very direct, very clear. I'm going to throw it open to my co-host Tex for commentary, then we'll go to Chuck for a couple of minutes, and then Chris. Go ahead, Tex.
Well, there you go. I mean, I think you have it absolutely. You know, you have, okay, so there's an emergency situation. You have a war or something, and therefore the government needs extraordinary powers, right? Well, once the government takes these powers, they don't often relinquish them. Many countries around the world are run under emergency military powers that are voted, and essentially they create a dictatorship that's never ended. You know, see Hosni Mubarak. among others. And so these are the types of things you need to be careful about. And I think Rand Paul has identified it pretty well. You know, some people think, oh, that's science fiction. That would never happen here. Well, why would it not happen here? Well, we have such a reservoir of virtue that, oh, Americans would never do this. Perhaps maybe there was a time when the country did, because you're in a frontier environment and everybody has to rely on each other in order to make things happen. And so there's a greater sense of trust. But these days, we know what America's like now in terms of our sort of moral compasses and that kind of thing, and how government power is. And, you know, do you want to turn this kind of power over to the government? I would suggest that no. It's a pretty bad idea all around, and not something that should be approved. And if it is approved, which I don't think it should be, but if it is, it's certainly something that should be vigorously debated out and publicly as to what we're going to do. And the media just treats this as sort of fantasy and it could never happen. So, you know, kudos to him for holding up nominations and at least getting press coverage over this issue, because I think it gets people talking about it. And, you know, people who are just trying to paper over this thing and say, oh, it's not even worthy of discussion. Well, you know, I just think that's absolutely naive. And either they are part of the problem or they're dangerously misinformed about how governments actually work historically.
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, the thing is that the reason that the Founding Fathers drafted the Constitution as they did was in order to check these kinds of abuses. And we can't just roll over and hand these extraordinary powers, you know, with the hope that the men we elect can be trusted to use them. You know, I've heard it so much lately. Well, I'm going to go ahead and take this power, but I'm not going to use it. No. And I don't know that you are or aren't going to use it. I suspect you are. Otherwise, why would you want it? And even if you happen to have the mettle to resist using it improperly, I don't know that the next guy will. So I don't want it to be out there, period. Chuck, I'm throwing it to you. You've got about 90 seconds to comment on what you heard from Rand Paul.
Well, yeah, I would just say the parallels from today in 1775, April 19th, are uncanny. What you have is you have a government that is willing to do the same thing that was happening over 200 years ago. Come and take your firearms. Why? Why is the question? Why would they do something that insane? Why would they even talk about something that crazy? Why would they want to disarm you? Why would they have the National Defense Authorization Act? Why would Rand Paul even have to even be saying some of the stuff that he's, you know, bringing to the attention of the American people? And he is bridging a gap that is far and wide, but is also very close to being connected. The Liberty Movement and the Tea Party Movement. Marco Rubio cannot do that. Obviously, if he is the chosen one of the GOP that has told the grassroots to go pound sand, I would say that that would be a dangerous pick for your nominee. Rand Paul is not getting any respect. And he's not telling you to go pound sand. He's telling you to go pound liberals. That's your choice.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, who knows? 2016 is a long time away. We don't even know if these will be the two guys fighting it out. But I think that they certainly represent two visions of the future of what conservatism will be, and also the Republican Party. Chris, why don't you comment on this, and then we'll go back to Chuck for his final thoughts.
I think that you know, this issue that Rand is bringing up, and of course, you know, most people wouldn't even have thought about, you know, the whole Patriot Act forward, you know, that Bush gave us, and any of the, you know, the Homeland Security, everything else that's going on. And Rand is willing to carry that message forward that his father started, which is vital. Now, here's the thing. When you look at one of the greatest leverages against the Republican Party has been the wars, the industrial war machine, and all that stuff that Eisenhower warned us about. Is they were essentially labeled as bought and paid for by that group, and they have an opportunity, especially with Obama being the warmonger that he is as a Democrat, it just blows me away. They have an opportunity to take a stand on this and to actually gain a tremendous amount of support in the public, because the people are sick of the wars. They just don't understand that it's both parties, and Rand Paul is the only one that's really taking that message out. You know, it's like he says, yeah, it's one thing, but think about, you know, when he talks about that drone attack, you know, they were just dropping a bomb, you know, a line of cars at a restaurant, at a home, the collateral damage. I mean, we've seen all the posts on this, and he's making a very good point. You know, it's always so much easier to go, well, they're the bad guy and it's in another country. But when you give government that kind of power, especially with NDAA, the Patriot Act, all this, you know, that we see going on in this country today, you know, it isn't that far of a stretch to go, you know, that could happen here. And that's the point. That's why we have rules. That's why Congress is supposed to declare a war. That's why the president isn't supposed to sit in his office and check off lists to have people killed around the world. All this extra power is not supposed to be handled the way it is. It was never supposed to be given to the executive office. So here's the point. You got one guy in there talking about this stuff. That is a resounding message. If the Republicans have a brain in their head, they will get behind this. This is the chance to separate themselves from, you know, and to gain power. So, you know, who knows? You know, I know what Rand is saying, because, you know, I've studied his father on this stuff, and it makes sense. You know, we are way, way, way past, you know, where we should be. And Chuck said something earlier, and I agree with you. I'm not impressed with Abraham Lincoln either. I just wanted to confirm that with you. Go ahead.
Well, like most human beings, I mean, Abraham Lincoln was a mixed bag. Obviously, yeah. You know, living south of the Mason-Dixon, I'm not a huge fan. But, you know, I do believe that he did some things right, a lot of things wrong. And unfortunately, you know, one of the benefits we have with term durations for our presidents is that, you know, it changes frequently, but sometimes that also tends to detract from the necessity of a long-term view of stewardship of power. And some of these guys do things that they think make sense at that very moment that leads to significant abuses down the road. And unfortunately, I think Lincoln crossed so many lines. He basically threatened the very fabric of the Constitution so severely that, you know, half the country decided to go form another country. You know, and they're all a mixed bag. You know, they're even this one, you can say he's a mixed bag. I mean, he's a mixed bag of crazy, but, you know, he's a mixed bag. Chuck, why don't you go ahead and give us your final thoughts and plug your website, and then we'll bring it on home.
Well, my website is constitutionalwar.org, and we're trying to go out and cover what goes on in L.A., as I predicted, they would move the RNC April meeting as far away from the East Coast as they possibly could, and they picked L.A. Now, that's where it'll be. So if you can't make it out, a lot of us are going to try to go out there and hold their feet to the fire and get the rules changed for 12, 16, and 40. You know, we at least want to come away with something. Maybe it's only 16, which is very disappointing. That's a whole other show, but we want to make sure we get something changed. So visit my website, visit anybody's website who's going out there and going to stand up against the RNC. But as far as Rand Paul, the final thoughts that I would have for you when it comes to that, Rand Paul is not his daddy. That's okay. That's probably a good thing. Because what Rand Paul has been able to do is he's been able to articulate the message of Barry Goldwater and Ronald Reagan better than any conservative has been able to since those guys. I mean, literally, since those guys. You want to look at some of the problems that we have in the Republican or conservative media. You can look at Rush Limbaugh, who I listen to every day. I love Rush. I really do love his show. But what Rush does is he brings on somebody like Arlen Specter right before a crucial election. He brings on Rubio to talk about amnesty and some of these issues that just... And Rush feels that he has a duty, and I think that... And I'm not trying to just criticize Rush. I think what Rush does is he doesn't cave in, but he just says, look, this is what the party establishment wants to push, so I'm not going to stop them from saying that this is one of the messages that they want to go forward with. And I think that his interview with Rubio was actually pretty good, if you guys go check it out. But the fact of the matter is, we need people that are going to stand up. We need guys like Tex and Rex. We need the people on the internet. We need the Tea Party. We need the grassroots to stand up and make their voices heard. If you guys don't stand up and make your voices heard, then the only thing that we're going to have is Brett Hume and Rush Limbaugh. And I don't hate those guys. I think that they do a lot of good stuff. They get a lot of good information out there. At the same time, if we don't have a grassroots campaign like the liberals, like the Democrats have, there is no chance for conservatism to survive. You see it in the rules changes. You see it all over the place. You see it as AM radio dies off and there's less and less stations, less and less local voices. If we cannot combat the Democrat liberal machine with the internet, with shows like you guys are doing, everyone that's listening to this, you need to talk to every single one of your friends and tell them to tune into the Tex and Rex show. Not just the Tex and Rex show. Every single one of these. Bard's Logic. You got to stand up. You got to get people involved. If we don't make this transition, the transition by the liberals will be made. It's already been made. They're already kicking our ass. You need to realize that they're kicking our ass in this aspect of politics. If you can't stand up and you can't get people to come to conservative shows, the information war is lost. So
that'd be my final point,
man. Thank you guys so much for allowing me to get my message out. Thank you for getting your message out. We got to stick together, or we should surely hang separate.
Oh, Chuck, thanks absolutely for calling in. Constitutionalwar.org or .com?
It's constitutionalwar.org.
Okay, great. Please check out Chuck's website. And, Chuck, thanks for talking up our show. And I think you're absolutely right. And, you know, thank you very much for being here. The point that Chuck just made is very true. And you know, the Democrats have been winning the information war because they're faster to adopt technology that works. They're getting people motivated on the ground because they're in perpetual campaign mode. And the very simple fact is that they're very, very organized and very, very easy to beat if you take the message out there that's authentic about liberty, about the Constitution, about local rule, rather than pulling the rhino crap about appealing to people based on their genitals and their skin color. So, you know, we have to do this, and it is up to each and every one of you. So, you know, that's exactly what Chris is doing on Coalition of Freedom. So, Chris, before I go to my co-host, I'm going to give it to you for your final thoughts. Chris? Okay.
All right. I'm there. I had you on mute. Sorry.
Okay.
apologize. I think everybody's spot on. You know, I don't know where the Republican Party's going to go. You know, they got a lot of issues right now. They have in the past before. They recovered from it before. I don't like the signs you know, of things that they're doing, like reelecting Boehner and Priebus and all the rest of this stuff, because that was a very unencouraging sign of things to come. But that doesn't mean the battle can't be won. That doesn't mean the grassroots won't win, you know, as far as that goes. 2014 is going to be a telltale sign of all that. And, you know, as far as, you know, the Rand Rubio thing, I find it, like I said earlier, I find it very interesting because it really defines, you know, it's the two young senators, you know, which, you know, senators typically, because there's only 100 of them, you know, much more powerful position. They're both high profile. They're both getting a lot of attention, and it's kind of fun to watch the battle go on and who rallies behind Rubio and who rallies behind Rand. So I find this very interesting, and I've been tracking it very closely. So we'll see how this pans out. But I appreciate the opportunity to come on here tonight.
No, thanks. Thanks for chiming in, Chris. And you got any shows coming up this week, Coalition of Freedom?
Yeah, but I'll post them as I do it. That's all I can say
okay.
about that right now. I don't have an actual
right.
schedule.
Awesome. Thanks. What everybody should do is in Blog Talk Radio, go to Coalition of Freedom and follow the show so that you will get a notification when Chris is broadcasting. And also on Facebook, go to Coalition of Freedom and join the group. And we are about to bring it home. So to my illustrious co-host, Tex or Rex, whatever your name happens to be, you want to bring it on home?
Yeah, well, I think that, you know, Chuck was talking about, you know, Limbaugh and, you know, what he was saying with the leadership, some of the interviews that he did, and the fact that, you know, he likes Rush, but he thinks that he may toe the leadership line a little bit too much. Well, of course, that's true, because he's afraid of having his access cut off. And that really is the problem right now, is that the leadership thinks it knows better than you. It knows better than you how to do things and how to get things done in Washington. And the problem is it is actually going and getting things done in Washington. And what it's getting done in Washington is the exact opposite of what people want to see. So there you have a leadership that doesn't represent what we want. They're acting as a valve, and they think that if we make sure that we act as a valve and we put all these rhinos in charge and in these places and we say, oh, but this rhino is actually a Tea Party favorite. You know, we'll put that label on it, and then people will like it. Well, when that person gets in power, they do the exact same thing that have been angering people, and you can't act as a valve like that for very long because the pressure builds and builds and builds. And so what they need to be doing is listening to what it is that the Republican voters are saying and what the grassroots are saying, because these are the real concerns of Americans. They're not managed media campaigns. Maybe they want to manage a media campaign, but find out what it is that the people think. Express that, and you will win. Tap into the sentiments of the American people. Democrats are disillusioned, too. Democrats don't like, you know, all the drone strikes, all the foreign wars. They don't like Homeland Security. They don't. There are a lot of areas of agreement that you can tap into and affect change in the country. But to try to sit there and empower leadership to sit on top of this and determine, okay, well, you've been selected, and I'll say that these people speak for the actual people, and when they get into office, then we'll pressure them and we'll make sure that they do exactly what the leadership wants. Well, there you go. That's the problem. That's why the American people think the country's in the wrong direction and the situation's hopeless, because if you continue on that path, it's going to continue to be hopeless, and that's why you need to empower yourself and empower the grassroots to go and do something about it and affect change at the local level, because that's where your voice is the loudest.
Absolutely, and I think that's precisely why the Founding Fathers gave us the constitutional structure they gave us, so that you can be one voice among a smaller pool and have a louder voice. And what the oligarchs have been trying to do is dilute your voice. I think what we've experienced with the dueling responses to the SOTU speech is, you know, we talked a lot about Rubio and Rand themselves, but really I think that this was just a stark and clear example of the two paths that are before you for conservatives and the Republican Party if it chooses to be conservative. That's up to you. I mean, the leadership clearly is tepid, watered down, and kind of just want to go along to get along to keep their positions, but the grassroots and the voting public aren't there. You've got two young senators with virtually identical voting records and both having the moniker, you know, Tea Party favorite, whatever the hell that's worth. But I think we've got two different visions, and it was clear far more to me in what Rubio failed to say in his speech than what he did say. He didn't mention the controversial things like the drones and the cutting of all spending, which Rand did. And, you know, I'm not advocating Rand or beating up on Rubio. I just think that they currently represent two directions that you can go in the future. And you have to be active at the local level. You have to be active in parties. You have to be active with your elections board to work on ballot access. And you need to engage other people. A great tool to do that is the Tex and Rex show and other shows like Bard's Logic and Coalition of Freedom. You can download MP3s of the Tex and Rex show by going to our